This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Yeah, Frank here, he's got his own billiard room.
Yes, what do you call it, Kramer?
The billiard room.
No.
The name.
The billiard. Not billiard. What? Not the billiards. It was... Come on, Rudy. What? Come on. We call it the
place to
the
be.
The place to be. Yes, it's the place to be.
Then I shall be there.
This is the place to be here tonight.
Time to play the game.
Party people in the place to be. Uh-huh. It's about that time.
Place to Be Nation, Scott Criscola and Justin Rosero. This is the Place to Be podcast.
Very nice, Mr. Criscola.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dennis.
I think they might hear Shockwall.
Actually, it's being John Akiyama is a better version of it.
What do you think, Woodling? You can finally tell Grant Owens you found new music.
I'll tell you what, I am impressed.
Mm-hmm. Sharon Lawson Bram? Skidamarinky-dinky-dink?
Yeah.
Skidamarinky-doo?
Hey, Nate, man, this is pretty much a highlight of my life right now. I had no idea you were going to be here. I've wanted to drive that freaking ho train of my whole youth. You're the man.
And I thought he meant Nate Milton, the Godfather from Kings of Sport. Do you really think that's the Godfather?
Yeah, I did.
All you have to do is break out that fuck money.
I ate the pie. Watch your mouth, you scraggly Canadian.
That's a bit much, you, who murdered the dog with the sword, and I'm being a little too much.
Yeah, I like Big Dick myself. I was just curious. 5 years! 5 years! We've been doing podcasts. And we have this. This is trash.
To do worse than Josh Richard.
No hungry children, no empty hand. One happy morning, people will share a world where
Place to Be Nation! Welcome back to another great episode of the one and only Place to Be podcast. I am your co-host, Justin Zurich. I meet you live here on this Monday evening. And Scott Criscola, I would say winter is here, finally, has arrived. Because today we had our first snowfall in Rhode Island. How about you? Did you experience any snow?
Good evening, JR. Good evening, Place to Be Nation. Welcome to episode 428 of the Mothership. I guess north of the state, there was a, quote, dusting. But when I woke up this morning, it was just wet. It was just rain. So I didn't get anything in my immediate area here. There was a little bit northbound, northern part of Connecticut that got like an inch, maybe an inch and a half. But nothing around here. I saw your pictures. Nothing near what we had. Looks like an almost blizzard.
Yeah, right. Now, yeah, it was probably about an inch and a half as well. So I waited it out a bit before heading into work. But as you know, the first one's always the worst because no one remembers how to drive in it. So that's always like a million accidents on snowstorm number one. But anyway.
Absolutely not. You're right.
So how's it going?
I'm well. Did you have a nice first weekend of December?
Yeah, it was solid. No complaints. And a
nice win for the Friars on Saturday against the Rams.
It was more than nice. That was a big one. Maybe because it shit all in the cereal of the Rams fans, because this is the big year. They thought they were finally, you know, going to do it. Finally, it's been seven in a row now, but it was six going into Saturday, and they figured, you know, this is the team. They're ranked. PC's kind of rebuilding, and I got to tell you, if they're not going to do it this year, Scott, it may be a long time. And one of my favorite facts, and not from a PC standpoint, from a rubbing it in your eye face standpoint, Brown has won two games since URI last has beaten PC twice since URI last beat them.
That's hideous.
So not good. Not good for URI. But we'll see. They remain. They got some votes. So still for the top 25. So we'll see. Well, they should turn around. The A10's pretty down this year. So I think they can still do some damage. But PC owns them. And there's no doubt about it.
Yeah. Speaking of New England teams, Saturday night I was at Madison Square Garden, because after 10 years of doing, you know, saving CBS's butt on many an occasion, the programming department actually got me tickets. It's like, hey, you want these? I'm sure, because we actually aired the game live. They're doing something at the Garden every year now called the College Hockey Showdown. It was number 9 North Dakota. They used to be the Fighting Sioux, but, you know, the whole Native American thing, so now they're the Fighting Hawks. They're actually the defending national champions, taking on Boston College, who I think is third in the country. It was probably about 11,000 there, and I would say about 9,000 of them were fans of the of the Fighting Hawks. I think the entire state of North Dakota was, I think, at the Garden on Saturday night. And it was fun. Kind of a unique experience. I had only been to a couple of college hockey games, but in, you know, smaller venues. But seeing it in a big place is that was actually kind of neat. So
I read today that it was negative 24 in North Dakota with the wind chill. So.
Yes, I guess it was a balmy like 39 in Manhattan. So
that is why they are in New York City instead. I had an interesting. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was about to say, and they won 4-3. Okay. So
good. Fuck BC. Exactly. I had a very interesting customer service experience at BJ's. On Saturday.
Yeah, you were alluding to this in one of our hangout chats. Please expound on this. This might be an episode 500, this story.
So I went to the, and for once, I mean, it wasn't my issue. So I went to the service desk to return a couple things, and there's this guy already there arguing with the kid. And a manager had come over, and my only beef with the employees was that the kid was adding nothing. Like, this guy had already escalated up to the manager, and he's standing there still in part of the transaction, and as that's going on, the line is like getting huge. Like, I was the only one there for a minute, and then like six people came behind me, and there, right, two of them were dealing with this one guy, and this other kid is like doing nothing. He's just standing there, and finally he came over and helped me and got things moving. But anyway, so the guy was, from what I could tell, the guy was upset because he used a coupon on something, and then I think he was trying to return it, but he was mad because it was something to do with the sales tax coming off. He thought it should be coming off after the coupon, but the lady's like, no, you get taxed first and then the coupon. So it was this rigmarole over like $2. I don't know what the hang up was on BJ's end for not just giving in and giving the, like, I don't understand what they were hung up on. This guy was really hung up on the fact that sales tax was getting charged prior to the coupon going on. And it got to the point where the lady was like, told him, like, do you want to come back here and look at the sales tax button on the register? So she ended up getting her boss, the GM. And, I mean, this guy's,
wow.
And this guy was like, he could not understand. And she basically said to him at the one point, he was like, what do you want? Like, what is the end game? Like, what are you looking for? And I'm like, you know, do you just not understand what's going on? Like, that's basically what she was saying to this guy. Like, it was one of the most justified, rude customer service. Like, you could tell she was at the end of a rope. And I finally just spoke up and I asked the guy, I said, you know, I said, call the governor. I said, call Gina Raimondo if you need a sales tax explained to you, because you're holding up the whole line. It's a Saturday morning and there's like 15 people waiting, and he just stared at me and looked back at her. He didn't even say anything back. But and so then I went shopping and he was still there when I went back to check out like a half hour later, arguing with the GM. I'm like, I don't know. Good I almost grief. Gave him $2 out of my pocket, but I don't know if it was even the money at that point. I have no clue what his issue was beyond the fact that on some level he was pissed off that he was charged sales tax prior to the coupon coming off his whatever the hell he bought.
Maybe he wanted our guy to win governor of Rhode Island. What's his name there?
Mr. Fung?
Mr. Fung. Maybe he wanted our man Alan Fung to win, and instead that other chick won, and now he wants to rail against the government, start a new protest or something.
Well, I shouldn't be doing it in the BJ's customer service line on a Saturday.
No, it's ludicrous. I had an issue with that. It was the other night. I was at Walgreens, and I mean, it was like 9:30, because that's the best time to go to Walgreens, and some woman was in line.
Really? Walgreens, is that packed?
Let me tell you something. Well, plus the Walgreens around the corner here, where there's only one person at the line, you know, one person at the cashier, and sometimes late at night, there could be like seven people there. It's like it's kind of ludicrous, actually. And this woman, I think she was buying bleach or some type of white bottle. Maybe it was bleach or some type of detergent. And
was it a UConn fan? Was she going to drink it?
Yeah, that's what I wish. I think they're losing tonight too at the Garden.
Oh, that's awesome.
She was complaining that the coupon. She had brought a coupon for like $1 off, and I think the barcode on the coupon wasn't working. And they were trying like all sorts of. It was $1. She was trying all sorts of circulars on the counter that weren't working. She literally wanted the guy to go back to the manager. 9:30 on a Monday night. Can you please go get another coupon? I want this $1 off this bleach.
At that point, I mean, that's when I got in trouble once at Stop and Shop when I worked there for taking 10 cents out of my pocket and giving it to a guy. Yeah, I mean, because at some point it's just like, here's $1. Like, go away, you know? It's like, right. I'm all for saving and coupons, but at some point it's not worth it. The time you spent isn't worth the $1 on, you know, whatever you do. But, right. Yes, UConn, I'm going to tell you the score. Are you looking at it?
No, I don't have anything up. No.
All right, I want you to tell me what time you think is left in the game.
Okay.
Okay, or where, what point we're at in the game. Syracuse 37, UConn 26.
I would say probably maybe 2 minutes into the second half, maybe just second half's maybe 2 minutes old.
We have 13 minutes remaining in the game. It's 37-20.
Jesus! So. Wow, that's actually playing at UConn's pace since, you know, they suck and all. Yeah. So
fun stuff.
Oh, all right. God. Actually, so anyway. it's a first of – it's the Jimmy V doubleheader tonight. I think Duke, Florida is the second game.
Yeah, well, thank God Jimmy V's not here to witness this. So.
Yes, that's exactly true. Nice little montage on Raw right now. Is that Jack Gallagher guy coming to the – or is he on the new Cruiserweight show? I like his mustache.
He's on the 205 show.
Yeah. Yeah, I like his mustache. It's very impressive.
Nice mustache.
His mustache. All right. Guess what, JR? Oh, you know, speaking of Madison Square Garden, I kind of felt pretty pleased. By the way, if you go to a game, if you go to an event there and you're in the 100 level, you can go down to that level even if you're not sitting in those seats. Is like where they did the whole renovations, and there's all like, you know, great memories at the Garden and you know, various great moments in Knick history, Ranger history, Billy Joel, boxing, that kind of jazz, and of course, obviously. Pro wrestling, and there's a huge WrestleMania 1 like display thing, huge, and it's got Hogan's tights, like there is real tights, they say they are, but a program like one of those generic Hulkamania shirts, like the ones that came out in 2002. Mm-hmm. But the coolest thing, Piper's boots. And you can tell they're his boots, like they're all beat up, they have the RP on them. I mean, they're really cool. So, speaking of the Garden, Roddy Piper.
You had to slip Billy Joel in there, huh?
I did a slip. Well, 35 straight.
All right, who cares?
Sellouts, 81 in a row. You've been there. Your wife likes him. Move on. And you like him, too. All right. Speaking of the Garden and speaking of Roddy Piper, let us get to this evening's festivities, sir. WrestleMania 1, we all know about it, but we're not quite there yet. But something had to precipitate WrestleMania 1. So, tonight. We go back in time to what would have been probably a February pay-per-view, if there were such a thing back then. So tonight, inside the Vintage Vault Refresh, we go to what was technically just a plain old house show, but it had a surname to it. So let us go to the house that Vince Sr. built. February 18th, 1985, from, of course, live, our home office, Madison Square Garden. Officially, it is called... The War to Settle the Score. And this might be one of the most geeked crowds to this point, and they just get better and better. Now, most of this show...
Did you give the attendance? Did I miss that?
Did I see the attendance?
Yeah, so I have it here, and it's incredible. So it's 26,092, with another several thousand over at the Felt Forum watching on...
Yeah.
Closer,
yeah, 26,092, which is just, I mean, that's just ridiculous.
Right. Jam-packed.
Jam-packed. And the best thing about it, JR, and we'll get into it later on when we have our, you know, our new segments to our new compendiums to our reboot, is that we're going to, there was another show that night. Now, of course, last month, two great moments occurred. Of course, we had our great house show at the Garden, and then up north of me at the Hartford Civic Center, the U.S. Express, Mike Barry Windham and Mike Rotundo won the World Wrestling Federation Tag Team Championships from a team that slowly moved up our ladder on the Network Adventure, Dick Murdoch and Adrian Adonis. There is another house show on this evening.
Like Big Dick.
Is our open? Let's go to we will go to the other house show later. But there was another house show because JR, we're kind of flip flopped because. Last month, we had Tito Valentine and Andre.
Yeah.
They're in the other venue. We'll
get
to that.
We can
talk
about it now. You want to cover it now?
All right. Let me just, I was trying to, Graham's site, historywwe.com.
I have it right here, courtesy of our buddy Jeff Jarvis on 218 in Louisville, Kentucky, the Commonwealth Convention Center. Only 550 people there. So
how big could that place be?
Not that many. Bret Hart defeated Terry Gibbs. Jim Neidhart defeated Tony Garea. Brutus Beefcake over George Wells. Ivan Putski over the Iron Sheik. Tito Santana defeated Greg Valentine by countout, so similar to what went down in January here. And then Andre the Giant and the Junkyard Dog defeated Big John Studd and Ken Patera. So these are cards that went on simultaneously in Louisville.
Those poor bastards in Louisville.
Right.
Oh, God. And I think the next night, were they near Neck? No, they're probably close to, Oh, in fact, a couple nights later on that, Thursday, let's see, 1920. Yeah. Guess what? One card was at Enfield High School. Okay. And the other one, JR, was at the Providence Civic Center. And to be honest with you, it was roughly the same guys there that we had that we have here at the Garden, except for some changes. But anyway, all right, let us go to the Sutton Report. What do we got?
Our championship roll call, of course. Hulk Hogan, 392 days into his reign. Greg Valentine, 147 to his. Barry Windham and Mike Rotunda, as you noted, our new tag team champions, knocked off Murdoch and Adonis on January 21st, ending Adonis and Murdoch's 279-day reign as champion. And our new champs are 28 days in. Wendy Richter, 210 days into her reign. And like you said, 26092 is the attendance. And we'll talk about the TV portion in just a moment. On February 21st, ABC 2020 aired a very interesting segment on pro wrestling in which footage was shown, taped way back in December 28th of 84. And then later, of course, included David Schultz hitting John Stossel after Stossel had called wrestling fake and Schultz gave him an open palm slap. I was backstage at MSG back on December 28th. So Schultz,
yes,
as we watched in The Adventure, had been kind of a very enjoyable heel, way off the
wall. It was awesome.
Out of his mind.
Awesome.
And we always comment, like, you know, how did this guy not make the first WrestleMania? It's because he gets shit-canned right before it.
Yep.
And the incredible thing is that they didn't fire him after it happened. And they actually talk about it. We just watched the TNT where Schultz is on and they reference the incident, which is insane to me that they talk about it nonchalantly. And what's even more insane is that same episode, Schultz fires a gun into the air.
Oh, yes.
Flips out. You stupid idiot.
What are you doing?
But so that leads to this airing, and then Schultz ends up getting pushed out the door. So one of the biggest, hottest heels in 84 doesn't make it to Mania. And that aired on February 21st. Some of these matches as well available on VHS and DVD. But more importantly, we take a look at what was going on television, because this full show, Scott, is broadcast on the MSG network.
Mm-hmm.
But, and we'll talk about this more in depth as we go along, but the main event was aired live on MTV,
mm-hmm,
scoring a 9.1 broadcast rating on
huge.
MTV. So, and that is just the main event that we'll talk about. So we'll get there. Like I
yep.
said, we'll talk about it in a bit.
Yep. And once again on commentary, Gorilla Monsoon and Mean Gene Okerlund.
And they really hype this up hard. Like, we have a lot of big stuff coming tonight, and they really push it.
Yes, they do. No, they definitely do. All right, let's dive in. Our opener. There's two matches on the. I don't know if you thought the same thing I did. There's two matches on this card where it looks like they're mirror images of each other because both pairs of guys look exactly the same. Our opener here pits one half of a former great tag team, mm-hmm, Mr. Moondog Spot, taking on Spotty.
Yeah, solid.
Bone and all. Yeah.
I would say it's former, a great tag team.
Well, I guess not. Former champions. Mm-hmm. Taking on the Pride of North Kakalaki, mm-hmm, and he was in our first match. He actually won one of our first awards.
Getting awards.
Quick draw, Rick McGraw.
So both men back here tonight this month. Hopefully should be better from McGraw against a better opponent than he had last month, which was the Spoiler, who was so poor that we ended up naming the award here after him for worst worker of the evening. Spot had a decent match with Mulligan back in January. He gets the opening slot this time around. So here we go. After some feeling out, we get McGraw striking first with the bridge into a pin cover and goes to a wrist lock. McGraw works the arm some more and picks up a near fall with a cross body. Quick draw slams Spot and hammers away at the arm, maintaining full control until Spot suckers him in and hits an inverted atomic drop. Spot slugs away and blocks the sunset flip attempt with the right hand. McGraw tries to punch his way back in, but Spot cuts him off and kicks away and then gets a shoulder breaker for two. Spot follows him with a hard forearm to the head and then to the middle, off the middle rope for a close two count and then hooks a chin lock. Quick draw catches Spot with a knee lift, but whiffs on an elbow drop, leading to another Spot chin lock. Spot throws McGraw to the floor and then rams him to the barricade. McGraw crawls back in, but Spot's just all over him. Spot misses a charge in the corner, giving Quick Draw the chance to catch his breath and crack him with the right hands. McGraw hits a suplex for the botched two count. his spot didn't kick out in time. The referee stops, and that pisses off all the fans. McGraw gets a backdrop and cradle for more weird near falls, and then slam spot for another two, and things are kind of going off the rails here. Spot survives more pin covers and gets a backbreaker and then heads up top, and McGraw pops up and slams him, but as he covers, the bell sounds for a time limit draw. You know, I thought this was all perfectly fine until it fell apart to the awkward pin sequence. Spot clearly thought the draw was coming and didn't kick up in time. I think that's where they thought the finish was. McGraw looked better here than he did last month, with more fire and a guy who could piece together the match in bump form. Nothing special, but I thought it was a decent opener. And, you know, like we've talked about in last week's show, anything with these, with the Moondogs or guys like that, you can kind of look at, you know, you're going to get at least like a floor that's not a dud. So I went one star with this because I think Spot's solid enough on offense and feeding. And McGraw was serviceable. But again, I mean, whatever. Par for the course for openers on these MSG shows.
I mean, it was, again, it was serviceable. We knew we were going to get our first draw eventually, and I'm sure we'll get more of them as we move along. Mean Gene is just out of control. Mm. He pretty much wants all the heels to lose. The referee needs to make up reasons to disqualify someone. It's so funny. He asks Gorilla at one point, Gorilla, let me ask you something. If a guy does something on the outside to another guy, should they be disqualified? And Gorilla's like, well, I don't know. I guess so. I guess it's up to the ref. Maybe the ref should think about that next time. Give me a break. Like, Jesus, Gene, stop being such a schlub. I mean, come on.
Gene is interesting. We'll talk about him a lot tonight because there's a point in the show where I feel like a switch flips, and we'll get there.
Okay. It was a draw. There wasn't really much anything else to it. We could give Rick McGraw the Juice Award again, but there's a guy on this show that most certainly will get it. You know who that is. You're coming up a little bit later on, but otherwise there's really nothing much to this. It was a decent enough match again. Spot. I mean, the Moondogs. There's just good, serviceable guys,
right?
Who just go in there, can give you 10 to 15 minutes. And
well,
back
can really fuck anything up. I mean, you know,
no, exactly.
Like he did. He fucked up the pin here, but that was more of a timing. But like his work in the ring, they're always going to be solid. Like they know how to execute. They know how to, I don't know, use power offense. They know how to bump and feed for the face during the shine segment. So it's like they're there and they're going to do a fine job. And they are perfect for these kind of situations. Just a 1985 house show is like the ideal spot for a guy like Spot. No pun intended.
Right. Yeah, no, it's and Rick McGraw is just one of these guys I think they want to push, but again, he just brings, you know, they made a big deal about his wedding on Raw. I mean, on Raw, on TNT, but I mean, it's just, you know, it is what it is. Yeah. It's a decent opener, nothing crazy. I give it a star as well. You can't really give it, you know, more than that. All right, next up, another match that's similar to the first one, except we have a couple of debuts, at least for here, JR, two new guys who you'll get very much used to over the next couple years here at the Garden.
Yeah, including the unpredictable one, Johnny Rods, mainstay in the WWWF. Dating back to 1965, was a solid heel persona throughout his tenure, mainly used as a jobber here in the mid-80s. In 1996, would be inducted to the WWF Hall of Fame by Arnold Skaland. Following his retirement, began training wrestlers in Brooklyn, would train Tommy Dreamer, Taz, Bill DeMott, and Matt Stryker. And his opponent, Scott Jose Luis Rivera, real name Marcelino Rivera Alasea, briefly wrestled in the WWF in the early 70s, but spent most of his time during the decade in the NWA in Florida. Rejoined the WWF in 1982, uses a prelim babyface talent, never progresses much up the card. Best known for being part of the tag team, the Los Conquistadors, with fellow jobber Randy Colley. In that team, Rivera was Conquistador number one, would return to Puerto Rico in 1990s to wrestle for AWF and WWC. I believe Kali was eventually replaced by Estrada, right, in the Conquistadors?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yes, he was. Yeah, there you go.
So, classic mid-80s house show match here. Just letting the crowd settle in. Rods works the arm to start things off as Gene discusses their amateur background. Rivera shoves Rods hard out of the corner and grabs a headlock as things just meander along. Rods punches and kicks his way back into control and has a sledge off the middle rope. Rods hits a dropkick, but Rivera trips him up near the ropes and fires away as the crowd rallies him. Gorilla chastises Rivera's lack of killer instinct, and it plays out as he takes his time in beating on Rods without much fire at all, and it costs him as Rods catches him with a kick to the throat. Rods slugs Rivera to the floor and then keeps clobbering him whenever he tries to get back in. Rivera eventually makes a comeback but comes up empty on a blind elbow drop off the middle rope, and Rods drops an elbow for the win. As basic as it gets, with nothing that stood out in any way. Rivera's lack of fire definitely didn't help things. The Rods look alternatively sloppy and crisp move to move. Nothing to see here at all, so I went dud on this one. I thought Gorilla was spot on with the just laziness overall of Rivera, not really going for the kill and not showing any kind of fire. Again, just, you know, Rods, for a guy who would become a pretty good trainer, is just, I guess you could see why maybe he never really progressed, because he looked good on one move and then the next would just look terrible.
Mm. It did seem like a basic training match is what it seemed like. Like a, you know, training school warehouse, you know, block by block wrestling match. And I find it funny. It was very interesting early on here, and it's not as bad when we get into 86 and 87. Gorilla and a lot of these guys that do these house show matches, obviously we've always noticed as we've gotten older and as we watch these shows that they're not as critical of everybody. Like, Gorilla acted differently on house shows as he did on like the TV shows. And it would be more prevalent when he's on the TV shows. Like, you know, he's not on primetime yet. He's technically still treated like the guy who just retired kind of thing. But he was, I mean, normally, he's all full-blown babyface. He wouldn't criticize a guy like Jose Luis Rivera. He'd push him, oh, this guy's one of the best amateur athletes, and he's got a big future here in the World Wrestling Federation. You know, the usual kind of cliched stuff to babyface jobbers. But like 84, 85, I think Gorilla was still pretty honest as a former active guy going, wow, this guy, like, sucks. Except he says it nicely. And I'm pretty sure it might be a few months after this is the TNT where all the jobbers are on. And I think they all pretty much say that. I think Vince kind of trashes them all in the end of that episode. Like, nobody holds back on these jobbers.
Mm. Well, they shouldn't. I mean, if you're being realistic, I mean, there's a reason they're not stars and they make big glaring mistakes every match.
Yeah, obviously.
And in a way, it was presented differently than, like, the jobbers that would come in the later 80s and into the 90s, where they really never did anything right. A lot of the jobbers here that we see on these shows are more similar to the next tier jobbers / jobber of the stars that we eventually get to know, like a Brooklyn Brawler, like a Barry Horowitz, you know, Reno Riggins, like guys that would actually get some offense in and be capable, mm-hmm. but always had that one mistake that cost them. That's what these guys are more positioned as on these cards, like a Rivera and a Rods. Like, they're not straight jobbers. That was more for TV on enhancement. The house shows, at least in my mind, rarely featured those types of guys. They seem to feature that next level up. Like, a Rivera may pick up a win on TV, maybe here or there. Or, I mean, probably not many, but he's at least presented as more of a threat that can wrestle versus a pure jobber that's just there to do nothing and get cleaned up.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, in this era, these early matches on MSG, you know, on these house shows are pretty much to, you know, kind of warm the crowd up. People are in the can. People are, you know, getting food, getting beers, you know, buying stuff. And they're like, oh, look, there's two guys on the wrestling now. Oh, okay. That's kind of cool. I like Johnny Rod's tights. they're pretty snazzy. Other than that, pretty basic match. I'll give it a dud as well. It's pretty blah, pretty uneventful. Next up,
it's not doing the times again. Well, I guess we mentioned the 15-minute draw, which actually went 14.
15-minute draw. This match was, I have it in front of me. Yes, I'm sorry. This match was 11-14.
All right, we'll get used to it.
Well, yeah, 11-14. The opener, well, I talked to Graham about this. The opener was supposed to be a 15-minute draw, but he has the time is 14:32.
No, he's nobody not needs wrong. Those. They did that often. They always would do that. They'd call out a 15-minute draw, but just end it. They'd ring the bell. That's not anything new. That's not a Graham thing.
So dumb. what's wrong with the last 28 seconds? I mean, you know, get over it.
They probably just wanted to end it.
That's stupid. Anyway, Johnny Rods wins in 11-14. All right, next, we have a big debut, JR. Not a debut for the company. But a debut here at the Garden, but a guy that we've seen a lot of. I know we saw a lot of him on the TNTs, taking on another house show stalwart that we actually saw last month.
Him and his stupid grandmother. So this is the MSG debut of Hillbilly Jim in late 1984. Big Jim began showing up at ringside events and decided to try his hand at wrestling. appearing as a guest on Piper's Pit, with Piper offering to train him, but would eventually be trained in kayfabe by Hulk Hogan. In reality, he was actually trained by Bob Orton. His first high-profile event. But like you said, we saw him all over TNT with the skits, with Granny Kim training in the little cottage and then working out with Hogan. And a lot of time dedicated to him on TNT. And that time felt wasted him anyways. But, I mean, he was presented as a big star. Like, he really was.
Right.
I'll give him that. He wasn't... You know, we think of what the Hillbilly Jim we would get to know, but at the time watching this, you could kind of see where maybe he had some potential to be something more. Like, have you gotten that feeling watching the TNTs?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, anything you're putting with Hogan should be something to take seriously. So I definitely think that. Yeah.
Do you think the gimmick hurt him as being legitimate, or do you think he could have still gotten over with that?
I think he's still kind of gotten over with it, except for the Justin Rizzeros of the world who hate hillbillies. But we could have stuck with him and no more of the – unfortunately, he won't be the last one, which he was. But no, I think the gimmick was fine. I mean, it's 1985, so, you know, gimmicks are gimmicks. You know, we have goofy ones all over the place. But I don't know. Do you think that we're JR, are we in like an odd phase where we're not quite into gimmicks? Like – the last real hillbilly-looking guy was probably an eventual WWE Hall of Famer, I would think, and that's Haystacks Calhoun was probably the last one. I don't know where he was from, Chicken Picking, Arkansas, or where the fuck he was from. somewhere like that. He was probably the last like legit kind of gimmick like that. Plus, all the heels were all foreigners, you know, Baron Mikhail Scicluna, and, you know, all the fake, you know, Nazi bad guys and that kind of stuff. Old Ivan Koloff. Other than that, you know, you didn't see overly those kind of gimmicks
right.
in the early 80s. But now, you know, this is Vince Jr. and he's, you know, rolling the dice. So now we're trying to get – he's trying to bring kids in. So we're getting kind of kid-friendly gimmicks.
Oh, and he's a hillbilly mark. I mean, he's been a hillbilly fan. It'll play out over the next few decades. I mean, he's obsessed with these types of characters. And whether it's because, again, like it's always been
said.
He
is one.
Right. That's where he grew up. And – either it's a fondness or he's mocking them, trying to bury that part of his background. But he's a hillbilly, inbred goofball, you know, like that kind of gimmick. And we see it over and over as we'll go through these shows.
Yeah. And incidentally, Haystacks Calhoun was billed from Morgan's Corner, Arkansas, yeah. Which, of course, doesn't exist.
No?
He was really from McKinney, Texas.
Why not pick a real place in Arkansas?
Why did he just
say
McKinney, Texas?
Someone was going to prove that he wasn't really from there? Well, Arkansas is way more a hillbilly than Texas.
Well, yeah, that is true. Fucking Arkansas. Texas? Nah, not really hillbilly. Arkansas!
Yeah, but I don't get why they had to make up a town. Like, aren't they afraid people are going to fact check it, go look on a map? Really weird. Morgan's Corner.
He was a chief pioneer of the sport's super heavyweight attractions. But anyway.
Chief pioneer of cleaning out buffets.
Yes, and he died in 1989 at the age of 55. So, obviously, he died young. So I think the gimmick, you know, it's funny. You don't need to die of sepsis. He died probably because he was fat and died of a heart attack. Getting back to your question about the gimmick, though, it's an interesting situation because we're in this in-between phase where we don't have a myriad of goofy stuff yet, but it's coming. We're trying to keep it still kind of with straight guys, straight-laced guys like a Piper, like a Greg Valentine, like a Tito, like that kind of thing. So curious to see how, gimmicks like this do play out over the next few, couple of years. So, I mean, do you think it's out of place?
I think it's a little weird to have a big giant hillbilly hanging out with your mainstream megastar. I mean, that's the only thing.
Like the big giant hillbilly.
I mean, yeah. I mean, it's kind of goofy, a guy in overalls. I mean, if they had brought him, country strength, but they put him in tights and he was just, you know, from the country. But like a pure hillbilly redneck character to me was, I guess not really redneck. I don't know. I guess redneck would be further south. But you know what I'm saying. This hillbilly guy with your main movie star top attraction didn't, to me, seem like it fully fit. That's all. I have a hard time picturing in this era a world champion looking like Hillbilly Jim or having the name Hillbilly. Like, they were so obsessed with mainstream coverage and breaking in through MTV. And I mean, look what they're at with this show. Could you imagine the main event guy was Hillbilly Jim? You know what I mean? Like, and he had the look, and the pairing worked. But like I said, just the idea of it for the spot they have him in just didn't make too much sense.
Mm. Yeah, I could concur with that. I think the gimmick of the other guy, his opponent, is much better.
Yes.
Because we love him. He's fantastic.
Of course.
From Nice, France.
The Michael Jackson of the World Wrestling Federation, yes. Rene Goulet. So a huge pop for Hillbilly, of course, as we've mentioned. Close friend.
You're going to say huge pop for Rene Goulet.
Huge friend of Hulk Hogan. Really cool atmosphere during his entrance as he stands tall above the crowd that is cheering him loudly. Woke things up after the last snoozer. Andy Warhol shown in the crowd as Hillbilly climbs in the ring. Gene calls out Hillbilly's boots, saying they were a gift from Hogan. Goulet doing his full shtick here, pulling on his glove and preening around. Jim overpowers the start, but Goulet is able to grab a side headlock to slow him down. Jim shoves free and plants Goulet with a shoulder block. Gene says Jim is the most uninhibited person he has ever met. So I don't know what he's doing that's making him so uninhibited. Does he pose for nudie magazines? Like, what is making him uninhibited? Jim keeps grinding a side headlock as Gorilla and Gene talk about his innocence and lack of experience in the ring, so he's uninhibited and innocent. Goulet gets to his feet on the ropes as Jim lets him drop hard on the mat and then does a cartwheel to celebrate. Goulet goes to the trunks and smacks Jim with something, but Jim kind of shrugs it off and quickly comes back with a headbutt, catches Goulet coming off the top and wraps him into a bear hug for the win. A fine debut match for Jim, kept short, plenty of shine on him. The crowd was really into him, and they gave him a big pop for his entrance and the finish. And he has potential in the good look. I mean, he could have kept developing. Lining him up with Hogan made sense, but again, just the gimmick behind it, to me, I never saw getting to that next level. I went half a star on this one.
I gave it a star. I gave Hillbilly the benefit of the doubt. I'll take the extra half star. I mean, it was a tight, easy match to watch anyway. I mean, it wasn't overly clunky. And we do get a first look at a celebrity that is in the audience on this evening. Yep. I don't know if he was mentioned in the beginning. I don't think so. But Rene Goulet called out a celebrity at ringside. And that celebrity was going to challenge him to a fight. Rene Goulet deftly ran away. And that guy was Mr. T.
There you go.
Was in the front row. Of course, the star of the A-Team as B.A. Baracus. And, of course, he was the iconic Clubber Lang. And I believe, J.R., yours and my favorite of the Rocky films, the great Rocky III.
Yeah, I believe so.
Yes, and he's in the crowd. So keep that in mind as we move forward. Next up, no interviews on this night, JR. Nothing in between. Meijin was too lazy to run back and forth before the MTV stuff.
Right. I just had the note that Goulet, like you said, jaws with T at ringside after the match, firing up the crowd. They get wicked into this when he starts jawing with him.
Yes. Yes, they do. But no interviews, no in-between interviews on this night. I think Mean Gene was too lazy to get up and go run down the hall. So, next up, JR, we actually have our first of three title matches on this evening. The World Wrestling Federation Women's Championship, or Ladies Championship, whatever they wanted to call it back then. I like women's. Women's Championship. Your champion, as you mentioned, JR, Wendi Richter, who won it back in July, taking on a protege of the former champion, the iconic Fabulous Moolah, and she debuts on our show here. Who is it, JR?
This is Leilani Kai, or Lani Kai, as some may call her. Real name Patty Seymour, which I believe was the inspiration of Patty Mayonnaise. Began training with the Fabulous Moolah right after graduating high school in 1975. Even though she was from Florida, Moolah thought she looked a little Hawaiian, which is why her character was created.
What?
I guess picture showing up to like some high school. I picture Moolah literally trolling high school graduations looking for women that she can
looking for Hawaiian women
bring into her farm of women that she owns out and farms out to all these promoters. I mean, just an awful person, Moolah. And just I guess picture hanging outside graduation. Hey, honey, you look a little Hawaiian. You want to come work for me? I'll get you up a big job in New York City. And then Leilani Kai, or as she was known as Patty Seymour, said, sure, I'll hop in your car. And then, but next thing you knew, she was living in a closet somewhere in Moolah's shack down in Murphy's Corner, was it? Morgan's yes. Corner, Arkansas.
Morgan's Corner, Arkansas.
1979, she began working with Judy Martin. Later would become her tag team partner as the Glamour Girls. The team would win the Women's Tag Team Championships on two occasions. So we'll get to that, though.
Yes, we will. Down the line. Okay. Go to town. It's a good match. Our first good one of the evening.
Go to town on Judy.
Go to town on Judy and Layla and Lanny Kai.
Lanny Kai!
All right, big match really in the card here. Moolah is advising Lanny Kai, adding some intrigue here. She wants her title back. Richter and Lauper. Of course, Cyndi Lauper with Wendi Richter. Get a mega pop and feel like huge stars, Scott. Richter reigning as champ and using Just Girls Just Want to Have Fun. David Wolf sits in on commentary. Moolah and Kai attack Richter at the bell as Cyndi stands on the apron. Richter has her coat on and Kai uses it as a weapon. Kai chokes away and pulls on the champ's hair until Richter trips her up and hits a slam for a near fall. Richter plants her with a shoulder block and then drops a big splash for two as Wolf rips the referee. They trade near falls on a sunset flip and then Kai takes her back over, hitting a double underhook takeover for two. Gene knows that Kai has a significant weight advantage, which shouldn't have made me chuckle, but it did. Richter dodges a charge, and Kai goes flying to the floor, where Moolah comes over to console and chat. Richter slams Kai back in for two, and then locks her in a surfboard submission. Kai escapes, so Wendi works the arm until Kai breaks free and kicks her down. Kai wrenches a front face lock choke as Gorilla and Gene rip the ref for being a mess all match long. Richter makes a comeback with a knee, but she's still hurting from the choke. However, she's able to catch Kai with a flying clothesline and a big boot for a pair of two counts. Moolah attacks Cyndi at ringside, choking her against the apron, which I thought looked pretty cool. Wolf comes over to check on Cyndi as Wendi gets distracted, allowing Kai to grab a backslide for the win and the title, and the crowd is pissed. Fantastic heat here, loud bullshit chant. Wendi and Cyndi get in the ring and chase off the new champ, and I thought the atmosphere was tremendous here. Not a bad match. It was well-focused and executed. It felt like a big deal. Kai played the role of steadying veteran heel very well, maintaining the pace of the match and knowing that she wasn't the sole focal point. Lauper was good as well, and the finish was well done, too. So good stuff all around. The in-ring work is eh. So I went 2 stars, and that's mainly just based on everything that we saw with the package around it. So I enjoyed the match, the atmosphere. The upset was great. The crowd is fucking pissed. I don't think anyone expected Leilani Kai to win the title. And all the stuff with Lauper. Lauper's fantastic.
She is. She's willing to bump. She's willing to, you know, to take it to the limit. She's trying to get it. So, I mean, David Wolf needs to go away and let her take bumps. I really like this match. I'm actually going to go a slot up and give it 2.5. I'll tell you why. It was the first match that I had seen to that point in terms of women that didn't involve a lot of hair pulling and, you know, bathing suit ripping. Mm. I think they really went out. They really wanted to be very athletic. And I think they really wanted to kind of outshine the other matches on the card. So I got to give Wendi Richter and Leilani Kai, props for this because I think they wanted to go out there and try to outshine the men. So it's not 5 stars. We're not talking, you know, what Trish and Lita would do in 20 years or whatever. But I think they really went out there and tried to work their asses off. So I'm gonna reward them with 0.5 star higher than you. I'll say 2.5. I think they really went out there and worked hard, threw themselves around. I mean, it wasn't overly crisp per se. But I really do think they went up shifted up a gear to try and really get this crowd stoked. Because I got to be honest with you, JR, you could argue that this is probably the number 2 feud in the promotion right now. Wendi Richter's entourage versus Moolah's entourage. It could be a notch above Tito Hammer.
See, I was thinking
just
Andre.
A notch. Oh, Andre. Oh, that's true.
I know those are the top 4. It's in the conversation. It's the top 3. I'd probably put Tito Valentine 4th when you look at scope of the feud when it comes to the importance of the promotion. I think the women and Andre is probably 2-3 in some order.
Let me ask you something before we continue on. We talked about the show in Mudlick, Kentucky, or wherever the fuck it was, Hillbilly's Backyard. Tito Valentine, I could see because you needed a main event something in the other arena. Are you surprised we didn't see Andre here? I mean, big show. I mean, most of it on. I mean, only MTV had a portion of it, but.
No, I don't think they need it anymore. Like you said, I mean, there's only a little bit of it on MTV, so they didn't need to sell that part anymore. You're going to draw just based on Hogan Piper to the arena. Mm-hmm. Right. No, I don't think they needed to sell. I think they were saving that for Mania.
Okay.
Because if you look at the pattern. The house shows are broken up with the stars, you know, in each town. Mania was this rare occasion where they were going to have everyone on one card. So I think that was the selling point for Mania. So you don't want to do that here. You know, the allure of Mania is that you're going to get to see all of your stars in one night. Hogan, Andre, Piper, you know, all of them across the board.
Right. No, that's a good point. All right. I'm just curious. I mean, I knew they wouldn't put every title match here. And incidentally, our next house show next month, I think I wonder if there's a split that night too. Ah, there is. Okay. So next up, so by the way, we have now a new World Wrestling Federation women's champion, and it is Lani Kai, or Leilani Kai. All right, we calm the crowd down with these next couple of stinkers.
How big, let me just go back to that real quick, though. How big of an upset was that to you? I don't think we're
it was huge.
Yeah, I mean, it was...
It was huge. I'll tell you why, because I think we all thought the feud was Moolah and Wendi Richter, and Moolah was eventually going to win the belt back. And Leilani Kai was just kind of a holdover match for this show. So I am not surprised. I am very surprised that Wendi Richter lost here. But obviously, Vince had other things in mind for the future so that we didn't know about. But yeah, I was pretty shocked. I was pretty shocked. I remember watching it on Channel 9, WOR, the next week. Because I don't think they did it live. I don't think this was live. Well, they might have simulcast it live. I remember watching it later on in the week. I remember it wasn't a Monday. But I was stunned. I was pretty stunned. Because she was crazy over. Mm-hmm. Wendy was crazy over. I mean, Cindy was over. I mean, and the copy we watched today, kudos to that guy on YouTube who morphed in the original piece of the intro. Because obviously he took his copy from 24/7 and they obviously dubbed out Girls Just Want to Have Fun. But the crowd was just crazy. Because you never could really tell.
No, when that was in there, too. On this copy, you mean, or 24/7?
This copy.
This copy of Girls Just Want to Have Fun.
I know, that's what I'm saying.
Okay, yeah.
The 24/7 copy didn't, so you couldn't really get the full depth of the crowd pop.
Right.
But this one was just, I mean, it was insane. Cindy was so over, even though the song is like 2 years old. But I mean, it was nuts. So I was definitely shocked. So, I mean, the wrestling world stunned that Leilani Kai, this Hawaiian-looking pale girl, is your new women's champion. All right, next up.
Your graduation gift right here, hon. You're working tonight.
Betty Grable. It's Joyce Grable. Betty Grable's an actress. that's good. Betty Crocker. All right, next up. The match that I thought looked exactly the same as our opener. I thought it was like those house shows where two tag teams that are feuding break up and face each other in singles. That's what this felt like.
They look exactly like.
So anyway, what do we have up here?
Same roided up midget body. And that is David Sammartino against Moondog Rex.
It's like all water fat. What the fuck
was? Yeah, they really did look a lot alike. I mean, it was two guys that had very clear shortcomings when it came to possibly being a star in the world of wrestling.
But they both looked the same that night. They both had black tights and black boots. I mean, they looked exactly the same. I think McGraw had a bigger mullet than David did, but yeah.
All right, well, the epitome of a cooldown match here. Gorilla questions the accuracy of the announced weights. I love his obsession with the weight. I know, I do too. Mark them all down. So Gorilla questions the accuracy. Sammartino works in early Hammerlock as we get a discussion around his family legacy. Get a close-up of Rex's bone, which is the highlight graphic of the night, with the screen title of the night, as Jeff Jarvis points out, this said, Bone of Moondog Rex.
Yes.
It was an awesome caption. So we get some talk about that. The match continues with some back and forth and control holds. Gene notes the upper body of Sammartino, but I think he has such an odd stout look, Scott, that weird shape, especially with his giant ass. I think Gene's like really gushing over his upper body, but I think everything just looks awkward on him. I mean, just a big ass. It's not even like a nice ass. You know, it's not like defined or like tight. It's not an apple bottom.
They look like action figures. That's what they look like.
Not even. He's like Baby Huey with that fucking... I don't think you'd wear white tights. You know, it would look like a giant fucking diaper.
It's like the ones, those AWA figures that came out, I think, like the year before. I don't know if it was JFA. What the fuck is that? LJN or whatever. The ones that came out, like Rick Martel had like four muscles, but they all like took over the whole front of it. Like, that's what they look like. They look like weird action figures. It's so bizarre.
Stout, fat, bizarre. Like wide ass. Like, I mean, like Faruka's like, damn, man, that's a big ass. Like for 1997 Faruka, you know, that's just a... It says there. And it's not even like a squat, like a leg day ass. You know what I mean? Like, he is just It's just fucking wide. Just XL Levi's, probably walking around and tucked into workout boots.
The members only jacket.
I should say, XL. I should say like 3XL.
He's not exactly wearing Jordache.
Oh, no, he's definitely wearing Levi mom jeans strutting around.
curling up the fucking the seam or the cuffs at the bottom. Oh, sweet, yes. Jesus.
His milkshake brought everyone to Madison Square Garden. So Rex works free from San Martino, shoots him into the corner, and then works the lower back, eventually hooking in a bear hug. Gorilla and Gene talk about the day's popularity with celebrities around the world, and things just meander along. San Martino comes back, and it's a back suplex, but Rex gains control, hits a hot shot, and then goes to a chin lock. Rex keeps on the pressure, slugging away as San Martino staggers around before David makes a big comeback with a flurry of punches. San Martino kicks and slams Rex before dropping a knee for two and then finishes him with a power slam. Again, nothing special. Had its moments at times just because Rex is a solid heel vet, but San Martino's just all over the place outside of a hot comeback and a decent finish. I went dud here, which to me is hard to do with the Moondogs, but I thought San Martino was a disaster.
He really is not his father by any stretch of the imagination. Not his father whatsoever. What they should have done here is what they were going to do at Mania. They should have done here, and then we could have had a better match at Mania, but we'll get to that. It's pretty much the same match, except without the draw. The match is roughly the same. Both sloppy messes, kind of all over the place. I also give it a dud. No wonder this undercard wasn't on ESPN.
I thought McGraw looked a little bit better than San Martino.
Yeah, he did. He did. That he did. Is Spotty a better wrestler than Rex? I don't know.
Yeah, maybe a little bit. I think maybe over the bit. Course of these two shows, anyway. Maybe we should track who's been the better Moondog as we move forward.
Who's the better Moondog? Well, that's Parv.
Who's Rex? Is that Latham?
Yeah, Rex is Latham. No, Rex is Cully.
Okay.
Spotty is Latham.
Okay.
Yes. So David San Martino wins. The length of that match is... Oh, by the way, the women's match... I should just keep this screen up. The women's match, how long did you think it was? Did it seem long to you?
Yeah. I mean, for a women's match.
It was.
It moved quick, though, because there was so much stuff going on.
It was 7:29. No, I'm sorry. That was the Hillbilly Gym match. The women's match was 11:49. Okay. This match was, oh, my God, this match was 12:27. Sweet Jesus.
Yeah.
So
this felt like the half hour draw.
Rick McGraw, David San Martino, and the Moondogs wrestled for a combined fucking 27 minutes.
McGraw should change his nickname to Long Draw instead of Quick Draw because those draws fucking feel like they go on forever.
Long Draw and Squat Ass. That should be their tag team.
Long Draw McGraw, fucking 40 minute draw.
Long Draw McGraw and Squat Ass San Martino. All right. So anyway.
No,
there we go.
Squat Ass. No GTL for David San Martino.
No.
He is not going to the gym. He is not tanning. He is not doing laundry.
He should go to that gym where Orndorff was on TNT with all the fat people.
As evidenced by his trunks, he's not doing laundry either.
No.
His giant fucking pull-up.
He needs a onesie. Speaking of bad work rate.
Excuse me, do you sell size 46 diapers?
Excuse me. Do you have big and tall Levi's? Oh, do you want You want the workman's jeans? No. The big and tall, please. Where does Hillbilly Jim get his?
How's he? He's not big and tall. He's big.
Short and fat.
Yeah. He's not even fat. It's just his ass. It's ridiculous.
Do you have those husky corduroys at Sears?
All right. He is husky.
All right. Speaking of wrestlers that are husky and not good in the ring, I guess we have up next.
It's like Mr. Potato Head or something. Or it's like they took like the Mr. Potato Head piece, but the legs are like humongous and then his little stout body just kind of drops on top. Like his upper body is short, but his bottom is massive.
Is massive. Oh, God. Anything. I think this is the most we will ever talk about David San Martino ever.
Sadly not. I think we're going to have much more to say, sadly.
Yeah, I know. It's unfortunate. We may not. Well, that's right. After a couple of next vaults, we may not talk about him again. All right.
Next up, we have another match. One of the best, one of the top heels in the company, taking on a very downward spiraled babyface, JR, and a guy that we used to really like. But after the first show and then after this show,
We really liked him. I thought we just made fun of his nickname.
I guess we did make fun of his nickname. I don't know. I thought we kind of thought he was cool, but in reality, he really isn't. Except for that one episode, the one hillbilly episode where he eats everybody's food. And now we know why. Who do we got here?
We got our man. My man, Nikolai Volkov, of course, the big Russian, against Sepsis Heath. So we have Russian versus Rebel, of course, the big sweeter, Sweet Hansen, the king of sepsis, comes out. Freddie Blassie's with Nikolai. He sings the national anthem to booze. The big sweeter's all fired up. Sweet tosses Nikolai outside to start things off and goes toe-to-toe with him, rattling him with punches as he returns to the ring. Volkov goes to the eyes to take over, but Sweeter comes back with a headbutt and more strikes. Nikolai punches back at him and chokes him on the ropes and then grabs a soft chin lock. Nikolai drops a couple of knees, but Sweet works free and starts to work the thighs. Sweet misses a charge in the corner, but Nikolai hits a backdrop and a really impressive deadlift power slam for the win. And you know what? On paper, you would have thought this may be the worst match of the show. I didn't think it was even within, like, the bottom three matches. I actually didn't mind it. I thought it was a decent hoss fight. They kept it really short. They threw bombs at each other. They lumbered around. Some energy. Perfect length for a Nikolai match. And I went a half star. I like the finish where he deadlifts Sweeter up. Sweeter a long way from our last show here. This was the kind of match he should be in. Just a quick hit. And, you know, he sold a bit this time instead of last month where he didn't do anything. So, actually, I didn't mind this one.
Sepsis. Sweeter's got sepsis.
Look at David's big ass in those mom jeans.
Husky corduroys. Sweeter could not really go any worse than he did last month. Nikolai's one of those guys that you can go hoss versus hoss with and, you know, get yourself through a decent length match. This one was 5:48. So, I mean, yeah, it's not like they gave him a huge snapshot to work with.
No, I would have even maybe shaved a minute off of that, and it could have been even better. But
if this was 2016, what would be more offensive, the Soviets or the rebel flag?
The rebel flag.
the rebel flag waving in front of the. Well, I don't know. It depends on your point of view.
We're back to hating Russia. That's a thing again. Remember?
No, that's true. We are back to hating Russia.
Cool. Russia's in again.
So there
they
we
were
go.
Out. They were out for like 25 years, but they're back.
Yeah, they were. Yeah, when they were just, you know, the normal mushy country. If Mean Gene had his way, I think all the refs would be fired. I mean, like, every ref is rigged.
This is a
you know, like every ref. Oh, come on, he's not even looking.
I'll give Gene this. I mean, obviously everyone knows his voice. His cadence is so good though too. Gorilla has the cadence too, but Gene just has that announcer voice cadence. It's like solely without the drawl. And without, like, the bourbon. You know what I mean? Like, it's it's more, it just lulls you. It's just, you know, he talks like this. And here comes the sweeter, Sweet Hansen. I got to tell you something, Gorilla. You know, it's like very, it's just so easy. It's just so easy.
No, I agree with you on that. When he gets into stuff
easy, like Sunday morning.
Center or in the old Summit in Houston. Now, what do you think about the old Horizon in Chicago. He sounds like a newspaper guy from like 1944. You know, it's like, you know, here's the news that's fit to print. Russia. Stalin comes in. And I mean, like, he could be one of those like old news guys like that used to read reels in the movie theaters kind of thing.
The good news today is we're allowed to hate Russia again.
That's right. Yes, yes, yes. Hammer and Sickle is chic.
And not the Iron Sheik.
Not the Iron Sheik, who, as we already said, is in Louisville, Kentucky. Ah, tuh! Anyway, all the referees are rigged. I think it was, didn't he say his name? I think Gorilla actually pointed his name out. It's like Gabriel Santos. Wasn't that his name? He actually said his name.
Gabriel.
Something like that. It was Gabriel Santos or something like that. Anyway. Again, I mean, you got two power guys. You can't really do much. You can't really make it any more offensive than Sweeter tried to do last month. But Nikolai Volkov gets the win. Heading into one of the hottest stretches of his career. Mm-hmm. So, all right. Next up, JR, a pretty big match,
Sweeter.
Just Sweeter. Next up, one of our biggest, kind of almost main event match level of the night. As we go into the camps of the Hot Rod and the Hulkster. for this one between the bodyguard ace cowboy Bob Orton, who we did we see him in January? Yes, we did. And taking on this guy also in that tornado match in January, Superfly brother Jimmy Snuka.
I didn't kill my girlfriend, but I did.
Vince, give me some lines.
In June 1984, the feud between Roddy Piper and Jimmy Snuka began. During a segment on Piper's Pit, Piper began insulting Snuka's Polynesian heritage, infamously smashed him with a coconut. The two feuded throughout the summer of 84 before Snuka took time off and entered a rehab facility to keep himself out of trouble. When he returned, Piper put a bounty on Snuka's head for anyone that could take him out. This leads to our match here where Piper's bodyguard, cowboy ace Bob Orton, is going after Snuka. And we'll talk a little bit more about Orton in a moment. The fallout from this match. So, huge pop for Snuka. Continuation of the issues with Piper's crew. Great match for this card as Superfly wants revenge, and Orton's cool, calm douche as always. Gene discusses Piper's bounty on Snuka as we get some feeling out. Snuka shoots Orton across the ring and ends up gets hung up across the top, followed by Snuka peppering him with kicks to the gut. Snuka works a side headlock and then catches Orton with an atomic drop and sends the cowboy to the floor. Orton's able to catch Snuka to take control, and he starts to lay in some blows across the throat and upper chest. Orton drops Snuka with a suplex, but Snuka counters with a splash off the top by getting his knees up. The crowd is fired up as Snuka lays in some chops and thrusts, and then lands a headbutt to the middle rope. Snuka tries another headbutt, and Orton sits up to avoid it. Cowboy starts to work over Snuka, but in a quick flash, Snuka gets a big flying sunset flip off the edge of the apron for the win and a huge pop. After the match, Orton clutches his forearm as Gorilla wonders if his elbow is broken. I thought this was fine, but kind of short. Never really gets in gear. The crowd heat was really good, and everything's well executed, but just never got kicking. It never got into that next step. I only went one star here, Scott. It was kind of disappointing. I guess I didn't expect too much more from Snuka, but the crowd was what really made this thing pop. The action wasn't really there. And we'll talk more about Orton's injury in a moment, but
yeah, the crowd was red hot. I mean, the match was kind of fun. I give it a star and a half. It was fun enough for what it was. Crowd was again red hot because they're an extension of the biggest feud that we'll get into later. And then, of course, the injury that really ultimately makes history. I mean, it's a historical injury, I guess you could say. That's really much, really all there is to say. I mean, I thought Snuka would bring a little more to the table because Orton obviously is the better worker of the two, but Snuka obviously was dealing with his own stuff, and frankly, really wouldn't last. I don't think he'd last too much longer. Throughout this year, so no surprise why. Otherwise, that's pretty much it.
Were you expecting
it was disappointing.
More?
Oh, I was definitely expecting more. I was very disappointed, but fun enough that I couldn't really dud it. I'll give it a star and a half. But Snuka's just played out his cards in the company. I think that was a guy that Vince Jr. really didn't want to deal with. He was a Vince Senior guy from the early '80s. You know, as a great heel and a foil for Bob Backlund. But he was probably a guy that Vince really had no patience for. So he obviously did not stick around. And now we know why. So there you go. Snuka wins the match in 9:59. Orton hit the steel ring post. Was on the Greatest Stars of the 80s set, by the way. By the way, a few matches ago, or the Hillbilly match, there's a tape out there, JR. There's a tape out there. Biggest, smallest, strangest, smallest.
Biggest asses.
Wrestling's country boys. Ugh. Why is smallest there twice? Okay. Makes sense
smallest
with that.
Minds.
Makes sense with that set.
Midgets and then small minds. Orton, we should note. So when Gorilla notes that he thinks he may have broken his elbow, in reality... injured his left arm in the match, caused him to wear a cast. Orton would turn that cast into a very recognizable part of his character, continues to wear it long after the injury heals. Of course, we'll see that month after month, and he does have it later in the night, the cast on already, but hurts his forearm here, and this is the iconic match where that injury goes down.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. So Jimmy Snuka wins as we get to, I think we got to the intermission at this point. So we are, what, seven matches in?
Mm-hmm.
Better, worse than last month so far?
About the same.
Yeah.
I mean, we, you know, Andre Patera was kind of our midway match last month. I would say that was better than Snuka Orton. So
it was definitely better, yeah.
Lanny Kai and Richter was probably better than anything in the first half of that show. So about even so far.
Yeah, no, definitely even. And we've had some, unique shaped superstars so far. So, all right. Why don't we take a break? When we come back, four matches left. One, two, three. Yes, four matches left. Two title matches to remain, JR. The World Wrestling Federation Tag Team titles are on the line. And, of course, the big one, the World Wrestling Federation Championship. Or, I guess it is 1985. We can call it the Heavyweight Championship is on the line tonight as well. But first, let's get some sepsis from our corduroy jeans. Because?
Sepsis Challenge.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I just want to make sure you're all subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Now, it's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search for and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation Wrestling Feed, Place to Be Nation Pop Feed, Pro Wrestling Only Feed, and, of course, the Kevin Kelly Show Feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And of course, as always, enjoy all the great action of Ring of Honor Wrestling and everything presented to you on PlaceToBeNation.com.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com, and we offer them to you across two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with the smash hit Clotheslines and Headlines, our steady veteran main event, and the beloved monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on all pro wrestling super shows. Relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the always contentious Dangerous Alliance podcast, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. On our very popular Place of Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, NBA Team, Lucha Undead, Geek and Sassy, and a veritable podcast heaven for comic fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both of those feeds on iTunes and rate and leave feedback for us as well. All of these shows plus others available at PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on the right-hand side of our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The PWO PTBN feed has changed its name, now known simply as Pro Wrestling Only, so it should be easier to find and indeed to say. All of your favorite shows are still here, including Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, This Week in Wrestling, and many, many more, including our full archives of tremendous content. So make sure you subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only feed today.
This is J.J. Dillon, the leader of the Four Horsemen, and you're listening to Place to Be Podcast.
Yes, of course. As you hear the song playing under us, Scott Criscolo, as we come back from break here, talking about the war to settle the score, February 1985. We are going to take a moment to talk some pop culture in the world of sports here in February of 1985. And the song you hear under us, the illustrious Careless Whisper by Wham, number one song in the country that week in 1985. To me, it's always been associated with one thing, love, and also El Gigante. But, Scott, first of all, give me your personal memories of the song. How big of a hit? And as we go through these, I want to know your comparisons to, like, the month before. So how big of a hit was this compared to, say, Like a Virgin? Obviously, made number one, so it's going to be a pretty big deal.
Yeah.
So compare that, and then you can tell us about some of the other stuff going on.
Well, it was, I mean, the biggest Wham song had already passed through, and that was Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go, which at this week was, like, down in the 90s because it had already kind of passed through. That song comes close to Like a Virgin, but no, this might have been their last hit before I think he...
So how did it knock off Like a Virgin?
Well, Like a Virgin moved... It might have moved on. When I go through the countdown, I mean, we're a month out, so maybe it... it's down. Well, this week it's at 17, and it had dropped 8 spots from the previous week. So it was last week in the countdown, it was down to 9, and now it's at 17. So some other songs from that album will start to slowly make their way up. When we get to next week's vault, I bet you we'll see a Madonna song in the top 10. Because guess what? On this week, there was not a Madonna song in the top 10. But Careless Whisper was number one. I never considered that Wham's biggest song. Wham's biggest song was Wake Me Up Before You Go.
How about
Go?
Last Christmas?
I gave you my heart. Was that George Michael, though? Or was that Wham?
No, that was Wham.
No, that was a...
Wham!
Wham! That was a seasonal-specific song. I wouldn't say that's the biggest Wham song ever. No, I mean, it's a good song. Great Christmas
song.
That
came out in December 84.
Okay. I mean, I'm sure it was on the charts that month. But it's not
George Michael's Sports Machine.
That was a great show. George Michael was a DJ for 77 WABC New York back in the 70s. And then,
that
course,
guy, the Sports Machine guy?
Yeah. Huh. Yep, he was a jock. He was a music jock back in the 70s.
Is he as good as Bob LaBelle?
Oh, I don't know. Bob LaBelle had that sweet tuxedo.
And I'm Bob LaBelle, and I just fucked your wife in that trailer.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I got confused the other guy. Art, what's his name?
Oh, Art Spencer?
Yeah. Art Spencer, yeah. Bob LaBelle, wasn't he the guy that showed up at, wasn't he the Assumption guy?
Oh, yeah.
The Assumption
Sports back guy? Every week just to watch the show.
I fucked your wife in the trailer. All right. So, yes, Careless Whisper's number one, but Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go was the big Wham song, and that's down in the 90s because that was the big song in 84. Okay, wrapping up the top 10 at number two was I Want to Know What Love Is by Foreigner. Number three, JR, a song that we'll be very comfortable with in another month, and that's Easy Lover, the iconic duet by Phil Collins and Philip Bailey. Number four, Lover Boy by Billy Ocean. Number five, an iconic duo, JR, that you and I are big fans of because they are awesome yacht rockers, the Great Hall & Oates, the song Method of Modern Love.
Yeah, not one of the best.
Number six, Neutron Dance by the Pointer Sisters, which I believe was on the Beverly Hills Cop 2 soundtrack, I think. Number seven was Can't Fight This Feeling by REO Speedwagon. Then back-to-back Eagles solo cuts. Number eight, The Heat Is On by Glenn Frey. And then number nine, which is probably the best song of these 10, and that is Don Henley's The Boys of Summer, which is probably the best song of these 10 songs. And then at number 10, David Lee Roth, because he had already left Van Halen, his solo remake of California Girls. So there is your number
one. Oh, Santa Claus, a gigolo.
No, that's just a gigolo. / I Ain't Got Nobody. This is California Girls. Number 11, by the way, Sugar Walls by Sheena Easton. I know you'll play that as a bump one day.
Sugar tits.
Sugar tits. And Like a Virgin, like I said, had dropped 8 spots from 9 to 17. And, of course, it was number one last month. We did our last one. Elsewhere in the sports world – actually, let's go to movies. The number one show that on this week was The Cosby Show, but it was a big year, the 84-85 TV year. We'll find out at the end of the year, JR, when we get to like June, who was the best show that year.
Maybe the Babbitt would take a sip of this wine.
Between obviously the Cosby Show. Actually, one show from each big network. CBS had Dallas, NBC had the Cosby Show, and ABC had Dynasty. They were the three big shows at that time. All right. That previous Friday, these following movies came out, and I'll give you what the opening weekend deals were. Okay. A movie called The Bay Boy, which was apparently a drama, made, and this is according to this website, $3,665 that weekend.
Is that a lot? 85?
That's really nothing. It's nothing now, much less 85.
Well, it would be the opposite. It could be.
I mean, no, it's nothing. Yeah, that's what I meant to say. It's crap back then. It must have been in some.
What the fuck was in The Bay Boy?
I don't know. Some art houses. Check it on a wiki. Next highest up was.
I was kind of hoping it was like Bay Boy, like BAE, like, you know, and it was just they're way ahead of their time.
Yes.
Starring Beyonce and Jay-Z, Bay Boy.
Yes. Nope. Next up was a movie called Fast Forward, which was a musical, made $2.65 million.
A musical. Kiefer Sullivan. Kiefer Sutherland.
Kiefer Sullivan, who's Sullivan.
Dave and Kevin's brother. Kiefer Sutherland, yes. And a Liv Ullmann. Peter Donat. Donut? I don't know how to say that. Leah Pinsett?
No idea who any of these people are.
Movie was filmed entirely on location in Cape Breton, primarily in Glace Bay.
Oh, it's because it's cheap to film in Canada. Yeah. Aaron George.
107 minutes, robust length.
For $3,000. Then it was a look up Fast Forward was a musical. That made $2.65 million. Then next up, The Mean Season. I remember this movie. I think this was a war movie. I thought it had something to do with Vietnam. That made $4.349 million.
A 1985 American crime thriller film starring Kurt Russell, Mariel Hemingway, Richard Jordan, Richard Masser, Joe Pantoliano, and Andy Garcia. It is definitely not about Korea or Vietnam. It's about a reporter from a Miami newspaper, burned out from years of covering the worst crimes in the city, promises his girlfriend Christine they'll move away, but ends up covering a series of grisly murders by a serial killer who calls him, telling the reporter he will kill again. The lines covering story and reality become blurred.
I see. Next up, a comedy, Turk 182.
Coming up this Thursday on USA Network.
That's right. These are all definitely Randy Savage.
Kurt Russell and Meryl Hemingway star in The Mean Season.
These are all Randy Savage 94.
USA Network premiere.
Coming up, Turk 182. Yeah. It made $5.56 million.
Okay.
Next up was Lost in America, which was a comedy, made $10.07 million. That must have been a pretty good movie. It's not made in America. That's the... Awesome Eddie Murphy
Obviously
movie.
Not. Stars Albert Brooks and Julie Haggerty.
Julie Haggerty, she was an airplane. The number two movie of the weekend was Vision Quest. Mm-hmm. I know that one. That's another good Madonna song. We may see that in the countdown coming up in the next few weeks.
We're on a vision quest.
I'm crazy for you. That's Matthew Modine and what the fuck was that chick's name?
Linda Fiorentino.
Fiorentino. She was hot as hell.
About a Spokane high school wrestler falls in love with an older woman.
But, JR, he's a college wrestler. But the number one movie that weekend, which made $45.87 million.
So, by the way, Madonna was in this first major motion picture. Singer at a local bar, performs the songs Crazy for You and Gambler.
Oh, okay. Sorry, yeah, she played. She sang Crazy for You, and that ended up being a pretty good song. We may actually get that song in the countdown at some point. And the number one movie that weekend that made $45.87 million its opening weekend is one of the most iconic movies of the decade, and it was The Breakfast Club.
I'm hungry.
So, there you go. Of course, that was Brat Packers.
Meteo!
All in detention on a Saturday morning. Different types of people. Emilio Estevez.
Superstars.
What's his name?
They should remake Breakfast Club with that being the point. Superstars.
Try to put on Superstars. Shut that. Okay, let's get to some sports.
How did we miss that as a storyline? Awful.
I know. Okay. The top 10 of the AP men's basketball poll, the top 10 for that week, because it came out that day on Monday. You'd be happy to know, JR, 3 of the 10 from our beloved Big East. The number one team in the country was St. John's, Chris Mullen. Number two team in the country, your defending national champion, Georgetown Hoyas. Number three, Michigan. Four, Memphis. Actually, Memphis State back then. Mm-hmm. Five, Oklahoma. Six, Duke. Seven, Syracuse. So your third Big East team. Eight, Georgia Tech. Nine, SMU. And number 10 was Louisiana Tech.
Wow.
So there you go.
Look at them.
Yeah. In the NBA, there were four games on this evening. The 76ers lost to the Cleveland Cavaliers 120-113. Andrew Toney had 43 for the Sixers in the loss.
Before his feet gave out.
That's right, feet. But he beat the Celtics at the Garden 2 years before. Detroit beat Phoenix 122-103. Clippers over the Spurs 125-121. And Mr. Bird had 30 as the Celtics beat Utah 110-94.
Big.
Your division leaders.
Mr. Bird.
Mr. Bird. Your division leaders that week.
Joe Bird.
Back in those days. For you, Jailbird. For you youngins.
Joe Bird.
Joe Bird. Who was Joe Bird?
Denise Bird.
Denise Bird. Dennis Bird.
He did.
Yes, he is. Your number one team, there were four divisions in the NBA back then. The Atlantic Division leader, the Boston Celtics, at 44-11. Your Central Division leader, the Milwaukee Bucks, at 37-17. The Denver Nuggets led the Midwest at 34-20. And, of course, the Lakers led the Pacific Division at 38-16. And there were only two games in the NHL on that night. The Oilers beat the Sabres 6-4, and the Penguins lost to the Flyers in Philly 8-2.
Ha! Fuck you, Pittsburgh.
So there's your snapshot. And, of course, on this week, spring training began for the 1985 baseball season, my friend. Your defending world champions, the Detroit Tigers, with that great team. And, of course, Kirk Gibson's big homer beat the Pods. The Mets, promising team. The Yankees, promising team. I'm trying to remember. That was Ricky's first year, but I'm trying to remember. Was he a free agent or did he get in a trade? I think the guys traded for him, so I don't think he started the 85 season with the Yankees. I think he started with the A's.
Yeah, they traded for him, then they traded him back there, right?
Yes, he went back in 89-90. Yeah, Eric Plunk and Greg Lifeisacat, right? Yeah. Rick Honeycutt. Right, was Rick Honeycutt a Yankee? Was he really? I don't remember that.
I thought he was at some point.
I thought it was Eric Kerplunk and Greg Lifeisacat.
It definitely was them. I thought Honeycutt was there. Didn't they trade for him at some point? Maybe it was years later, and then he didn't. I feel like he came after the non-tender trade deadline, so he didn't wasn't like playoff eligible. 95, yeah. He played. That was the year. I don't think he made the playoff roster. I think they traded for him like in September or whatever.
Oh, really? Was that like Canseco in 2000? Or did he make the roster?
Yeah, he made the roster. He played.
He did make it, right? Because I think he had a bat against the Mets in the World Series. So anyway, we'll get more. That'll be fun once we get into like April and May. We'll get into the baseball season and check out how our lineups look. Okay. Don Mattingly, of course, won the batting title that previous season.
All right, so. Let's move on. So we go back to MSG.
Yes.
Where Howard Fink, reveals that officials are forcing Roddy Piper to do a live Piper's Pit right here in Madison Square Garden next month with Mr. T as the guest. So, big time announcement here coming out of the half.
Yes. March 17th is the date for that next house show. And I don't believe JR Hogan is there. I believe he will be at the other venue that evening. So I think Mr. T will be on his own.
We'll see.
So, or maybe not. Speaking of, next up we get back into the groove. Second half of the show begins with a battle of two guys whose feud started JR infamously on a November episode of TNT.
Over paint. Tony Atlas began his career as a bodybuilder, winning the Mr. USA crown three times. Began in pro wrestling in 1974 to being trained by Larry Sharp. Traveled around the territories working for Jim Crockett, World Class, WWC, AWA, and eventually WWF. With the distinction of being the first person to press slam and pin Hulk Hogan. In the WWF, he teamed with Rocky Johnson to pin the Wild Samoans to win the tag team titles, becoming the first African-American team to hold those belts. When they lost the belts and Johnson left, Atlas was being set up for an intercontinental title run, but issues with drugs caused him to be pushed down to the mid-card, left in 1987, made a second run of the company in 08, coming back as the heel manager, had been inducted into the Hall of Fame of 06, and of course best known for needing a cell phone and hiding his cash in his mattress. world-class painter. Good power matchup on paper here with Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff. Feud had began playing out on TNT, where Paul used some very choice language, as we recall. If you want the specifics, you can check out the Network Adventure series on PlayStation.com.
Indeed.
Say it was 1985, and Paul wasn't fond of the black man. So you can let your imagination take it from there. Atlas looks fantastic here. Jacked up but lean. Great heat on Orndorff as he stalls and plays it up, frustrating a pacing Atlas. Atlas works a quick headlock and drops Mr. Wonderful with an atomic drop and back suplex before rattling him with a headbutt. Atlas presses him and then sits on the top rope and pats his chest to mess with him. Orndorff eventually lands a cheap shot and then nails Atlas with a series of punches to the head and knees to the back before cracking him with a hard elbow to the top of the head. Atlas shrugs it off, spikes Orndorff with a stiff pile driver to a good pop, and then drills him with a hard knee to the face and a headbutt off the middle rope for two. Orndorff recovers, catches Atlas with a bridging back suplex to win the match. I thought the bout was actually building pretty well, but never had much of a heat segment. Finish just kind of comes out of nowhere. The power stuff was good. The pile driver was really good. And Atlas looked strong. Wish this actually went a bit longer. I was just kind of getting settled in and getting into it a little bit. And then it ended. I was looking for more of a heat segment with Orndorff working over Tony. And I felt like for the feud they've had, which has had some pretty decent buildup, it was a little, I don't know, just felt a little light. They only go 6 minutes.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of odd too. Yeah, they go 6:08. Orndorff obviously had to be the hotter guy here because he had he had things going on down the line, so the win for him was easy. Wow, Tony Atlas was in great shape, but he maybe had to be nominated for a trophy at the end of our show because I mean he's just fucking huge. It was a little clumsy, but I guess not bad. It could have been worse for two guys. And Orndorff was kind of in his, you'd have to say Orndorff was probably in his prime in ring right now. So I'm not surprised he won. I thought the match should have been a little better. I'll give it a star. Because Tony Atlas is pretty limited. And after the tag title loss with him and Rocky Johnson, you really don't see much of Tony Atlas after this. So you see him a few times. I think he might be on a nationally televised show, which we'll talk about soon. Other than that, I don't think you really see much of him after this. So Paul Orndorff gets the win, but it will not be the last.
You feel like they kept this short because he was coming back out later, or do you think they just figure these two guys can go long?
I don't think this. Yeah, no, these guys cannot go on more than 6 minutes. They're lucky they went this far. No, I don't think anything to do with that. I think him winning had to do with what happened later on in the evening.
Were you disappointed at all, though, because of the build that we saw on TNT? Like, do you feel like they should have given them more?
Yeah, and I'm surprised, to be honest with you, that Gorilla and Mean Gene really didn't talk about it. You figure they'd have gotten into it, or I don't know if they should have replayed the clips, but, well, it was 1985. I don't think they really gave a shit at that point. But I'm surprised because, really, I mean, this feud started on TNT. You'd have thought that they would have... referred to it, but they didn't. So it's a bummer because, I mean, obviously you can't do that for every house show, but for the ones where you're going to get the biggest audience,
right?
You would think that they would add a little extra something to kind of spark any of these matches that do have any kind of backstory to them. That was more disappointing for me. But I don't think the length had anything to do with Orndorff later on. I think it more had to do with, that they just couldn't go more than 6:08. That's about the extent of it for them. So,
yeah.
So Paul Orndorff gets the victory, and we move on.
Okay.
Our next match, JR, our second title match of the evening. Mm. The World Wrestling Federation Tag Team Champions on the line, the belts, your champions, the U.S. Express of Mr. Windham, Mr. Rotundo, taking on, oh, right, here we go. Not one, but two men behind.
Yeah, two men behind the mask. So, the spoiler and the assassin. Of course, spoiler, awful last month. So bad that we named the Worst Worker Award for him. The assassin, Joseph Hamilton, most of his wrestling career spent in the NWA territories under a mask as part of the Assassin's tag team. He was Assassin number one. Did appear on two major cards at the NWA, Starrcade 83 and 84. His first, and albeit very short, appearance in the WWF. Jody Hamilton, I believe, is what he'd eventually be known as, at least by his friends. And our new champs, brand new champs, pretty stacked card here with another title match on tap. The Assassin's baby blue tights, I thought, kind of looked absurd. Did you agree? That was kind of a...
Yes.
I always picture the Assassins in gold.
Yeah, me too. That was kind of an odd color.
Yeah.
Especially his heels. champs get a huge pop, led out by Lou Albano. Rotundo drills Assassin with a dropkick off the bell, tags in Windham, hits a bulldog in, gets the win. I like this. I thought it was really fun. It was unexpected. I liked it as a squash. It makes the champs look awesome. They came out fast looking for a quick strike win, and they got it. So many times these matches start fast, and the guys like strike quick looking for that quick win, and it never comes. You know, the other team escapes or whatever, but this time it actually happened. So it's kind of cool. It adds credence to that psychology that you should go for that quick win because you never know when you could get it. So I kind of like that. I thought it was good booking. Mm-hmm. And no one wanted to watch the fucking spoiler anyway, so this is perfect.
No. Nah, this worked out perfectly. And it makes Windermere Rotunda look really strong. I would no grade this probably. It's kind of hard to grade a squash of something like this, but I mean, this was needed. You wanted to make Windermere Rotunda strong, considering that nobody saw. I mean, you know, Hartford did see the title win, but you need to establish it to the New York crowd. So this was a big win for Windermere Rotunda. Make them look strong as tag champs. Mm-hmm. Kind of the new era here, new baby face. So, and the spoiler. I mean, just when you saw the spoiler and the assassin, you think these fucking guys aren't going to win shit. Hey, come on. So there you go. Your tag team champions remain.
Mercifully short. Yes. By the way, UConn won that game by two.
Could you believe that? My brother texted me. They outscored him 26-13 down the stretch. Fucking believable. Whatever.
They both suck. I don't care if either of them lose.
I don't really care either. Syracuse is a bunch of turncoats, just like Pitt. Next up, JR. Another iconic jobber against a guy that I think Parv has comp sets of this guy.
Probably not. Don Morocco, the Magnificent One, against Salvatore Bellomo. We saw Sal last month, but we'll talk about him a bit here since we didn't. The Belgian board. Salvatore Bellomo began his three-decade wrestling career in 1974, joined the WWF in 1983, considered a solid in-ring worker. Throughout 83 and 84, he actually got a bit of a push, beating guys like Johnny Rods and Tony Colon on a regular basis. Or Tony Colon, either way. Bellomo lost to Bob Backlund in Philadelphia in August 1984. It should be Backlund's final WWF match of the 80s. By 1985, Bellomo had dropped to a full jobber status. We would later move on to Eastern Championship Wrestling in the early 90s. Become part of the first ever ECW heavyweight title match, losing to Jimmy Snuka, retired in 2006. Sal Bellomo, active for quite a while. Sal getting a spot late in the card here, Scott. A nice spot against Morocco, being rebuilt as an upper card heel with Mr. Fuji, who has coached him up with martial arts offense and his repertoire. Morocco bows to Fuji, but Bellomo catches him off the bell and smacks him around until Morocco slugs him down and goes to the Asiatic Spike. Bellomo tries for a blind dive off the middle rope, but Morocco catches him with a power slam, tries to hit the, and then hits the inverted pile driver for the quick win. Again, another good showing from Morocco. Another quick bout, effective as Morocco continues to be rebuilt. Shows some energy here too that you don't always get from him. You get a lot of laziness often out of Donny Boy, but he actually is pushing it here and works pretty hard in the short sprint. So I was fine with this one too.
You're not gonna. I mean, Morocco is one of my favorite heels, and it's still. I mean, these first two, MSG matches we've talked about. Still perplexes me about what happens the next couple months. I just don't get it. Something must have happened, but we'll explain why I'm saying this in the next couple shows. But, I mean, these first 2 months, he's red hot. I mean, big-time heel. Has Mr. Fuji as his manager, the devious one. And poor Sal Bellomo. That guy had more TNT shots than, like, Hogan. He was making pizzas. He had a little Italian dinner. You know, making meatballs and, you know, making the fucking, the boats out of the pages of the WWF. Here, if you don't want to read the WWF magazine, make a ship out of it. Why not? Poor Sal.
Ship a poor Sal. Ship and sent him out.
Go Sal.
The, what'd you think of Morocco introducing the martial arts? There was a bit much.
He wasn't quite a master of the martial arts.
I like how just anything, because he's, in cahoots with an Asian man, he's going to do all these martial arts maneuvers, which were just, like, absurd.
I like that Mean Gene was trying to make it sound like he knows what the fuck they're talking about, And karate and jujitsu and Gorilla's like, and kung fu.
The Asiatic Spike.
He had look at that thumb. That should be illegal. I'm surprised Mean Gene didn't expect the referee should cut Morocco's thumb off for it being illegal. you know, oh, come on, give me a break.
This is ridiculous.
You shouldn't have a thumb.
This fat white man stumble through trying to do like martial arts moves, and they're selling it like he's really been in the dojo with Fuji. Working hard on him.
He should just keep power moves and power drivers and move on. The devious one, Mr. Fuji, in my corner. So, Don Morocco gets the win, and Sal Palomo doesn't. But we'll see more of these of our fine jobber friends over time. Now, JR, they kind of do like an interlude.
Mm-hmm.
To get us from the MSG network to simulcast
in the nude.
Interlube in the nude?
No.
No one chatterbaits.
No.
So we kind of go from MSG to now officially MSG and MTV.
Yes. And there's such a noticeable switch, but before that we get Edouard Compatier comes out.
Edouard Compatier.
Quick recognition from the Fink. It's really cool because they almost they reset the commentary, and Gene like completely turns into like wrestling extraordinaire announcer. Like whatever he was before, he becomes the perfect pitchman for the World Wrestling Federation. Like I don't think Gorilla could have done what he did when they come back to that MTV broadcast. Like I thought they do a I thought he did a fantastic job. They reset the commentary, welcome in the MTV audience. He sets the stage. He sound like his voice completely changes to like this much more serious, yet relatable style. I thought it was a really cool switch that he flipped. It was like this snapped out of meandering through this house show, and all of a sudden he knew he was like on like national TV, and he really turned it on.
Mm.
Like I don't think Gorilla could have done what he did.
Right. No, probably not. Because, I mean, Gene still has that salesman feel and can pitch it like that. I think Gorilla was still kind of getting accustomed to what his role was at that time. But Mean Gene, I mean, remember, 10 years in the AWA, he had to sell some of those fucking schlocky feuds.
Oh, yeah, I don't know if Gorilla ever could have even done what he did here. Like, as far as, like, Gene, even though he was a bald, short man with a little mustache, for some reason feels like, I don't know, like you can identify with him a bit with this audience. You know what I mean? That's how I felt, at least. He felt like a guy you could kind of get behind.
Yep. Yeah, and I think that's he kind of, because, you know, Gorilla by nature was pretty much a wrestling guy, and that was it. I don't think he understood anything in the pop culture realm other than Muhammad Ali. Whereas Mean Gene, I think, kind of got the whole, all right, I need to kind of start selling as if, to these other 20-somethings and teenagers that are watching here, and I'm trying to kind of hook them in. So I think that I think it was good for Mean Gene to kind of flip the switch, and as much as I'm kind of breaking balls about it and about Mean Gene's announcing performance at the table, he definitely fit better in this role, kind of being like the pitch man and the host as we kind of up the networks and up the viewership. Clearly, as you mentioned, a 9.1 on MTV, which is pretty good for 1985. Remember, MTV was 5 years old at this point, about 4.5 years old, and still trying to find its footing. So I think this is a big deal for MTV as much as it is for the WWF, really. We talked about it with Mr. D'Amato and Mr. Greenhouse on the MTV podcast we did back in August, that this was just as big a deal for MTV as it was for the WWF to get this kind of exposure for them as a network.
What was their biggest thing before this? Did they have anything besides like music videos? Like at this point, that was
they
like
did. They did, I think starting it, well, they launched 81. I think like spring 82, they started doing like live drops from like spring break. They go down to Daytona, you know, chicks in bikinis, and they play some, you know, music and stuff. Occasionally on Friday night or Saturday nights, they would do like a quick 1 hour live concert from a venue in the Northeast, probably in New York City, because it was easy for them because that's where they were. Other than that, not really. I mean, maybe they did the re-airs of big concerts. Like there was a big concert called the US Festival. They might have done something live from there. Live Aid wouldn't be till that summer. That was their next big thing. They would do Live Aid that July. But I don't think anything before that. So this was a big deal for MTV. Plus, on top of the fact that they were trying to gain a new audience, a bigger audience too, just like the WWF was. So it was a perfect partnership for them. And Vince, I think, was
brilliant.
Was
there a ton of coverage beyond these shows? Like, how much interaction was there between, like, wrestling and MTV besides, you know, the one we had in 84 and then this one and a couple offshoot? You know, was it a regular presence?
No, not really. I think it started, like, mid to late 84. Hogan would come on MTV, and he wouldn't really guest VJ, but he would, like, he wouldn't guest VJ, but he would come on and do, like, a quick hit with, like, Mark Goodman or Alan Hunter or J.J. Jackson or one of those guys, or Martha. And that would pretty much be it. I really don't think it was that crazy. After the brawl to end it all. But then when they got into the new year, when they got into 85, then they started going crazy, and Mr. T would come on, and these next couple of months would be crazy. MTV promoted WrestleMania just as much as, you know, the company did.
Right.
So it was a big deal. But before that, not really. They were trying to get their feet wet with concerts and such. So it took them some time to gain a national footing. Because there were a lot of cable networks that didn't have MTV. Even by early 85, they still didn't have them. So it was definitely a partnership made in heaven for both of them. Definitely.
Okay.
Unfortunately, some of the celebrities would...
it's an interesting mix.
Yeah, and they would definitely seem out of place. And there was one line that I remember today that one actor would say at the end that kind of made me chuckle. I think he was being a smart ass, but we'll get to that when we get to the post-match interviews. So here's our main event, JR. The first time here on our Vintage Vault Refresh, the World Wrestling Federation Heavyweight Championship, because that's what they were calling it back then, on the line, your champion, the Hulkster, who was in Hartford last month, so this is his first MSG visit in a few months, and the Hot Rod. Of course, this match was announced on the house show last month, JR. We made that announcement. But there is a lot wrapped into this.
Mm-hmm. So on December 28th, 84, Cyndi Lauper presented Lou Albano with an award. Roddy Piper, not a fan of the Rock and Wrestling connection, so during the presentation, Piper attacked both Albano and Cyndi Lauper. Hogan came to the defense, which leads us to this match here for the World Championship. Lots of build across TNT and all the syndicated shows for this thing. Like you said, a lot woven in. Ties into the women's feud as well, because they presented Hogan and Richter together a lot as kind of the co-brand champions in WWF.
Yes.
You know, they were together quite a bit. So that ties in Lauper and Albano to an extent, who kind of semi-manages Hogan, but not really during this little bit. So there's lots going into this match, and it really is a massive main event. The atmosphere is, like, fantastic about all of this. I mean, it's a big-time match with a lot of hype. Piper pretty much, you know, coming off an epic feud with Jimmy Snuka and Tonga Kid in 84. This was a natural evolution for him to step up and battle Hogan for the title. It seemed obvious from the start. So before the match, we actually get... So we cut into MTV, and we get some comments from various celebrities. Then we get predictions from some wrestlers. So here's the celebrities that weigh in. First we get pre-taped comments. Bobby Heenan, Paul Orndorff, David Schultz, and Piper about Piper's action as the Lauper and Albano. And here is the list of people that talked both on Piper's actions and then pre-taped interviews, and then leading to more comments. So here's all the people. These are wrestlers and celebrities included. Gloria Steinem, Jimmy Snuka, Bruno Sammartino, Patti Smith, Ted Nugent, Dee Snider, Geraldine Ferraro, Dick Clark. Then Hogan talks, and then we get more footage. And then we get Timothy White, Merle Ginsburg, Vic Garabini. Then we get a video package on Piper's background, included in a video package on Hogan's background, featuring predictions on Hogan versus Piper from Mr. Fuji, Hillbilly Jim, Brutus Beefcake, Dee Snider, Big John Studd, Little Richard, Freddie Blassie, Blackjack Mulligan, David Wolf, Nikolai Volkoff. And then we get even more comments and, of course, more stuff after. But the most illustrious of all of this, of all the people that came out to show up and talk, the one and only...
sings it.
Your back's to the girl now.
She sings it.
Good old Kenny Loggins in the house.
Yes.
Adam Taylor, Peter Wolf, and on all the luminaries here at Madison Square Garden here tonight. So
Michael McDonald.
Yeah,
it was either. He was there. He would have sang his opinion. I like Roddy Piper in the bagpipes.
It's funny because I thought he just went anywhere Loggins went and kind of sang him along. But...
The tag team champions of Yacht Rock right there.
Wait in the car, Michael. So, massive main event. Gene and Gorilla reset the commentary. Welcome everyone in, like we said. Piper gets the full bagpipes for his entrance, and it feels like a big-time fight. He gets booed like crazy. Orton is with Piper, his arms in the sling after earlier, like we mentioned. Bob Costas comes in as a guest ring announcer. That adds to the excitement. And then Hogan, Lauper, and Albano come storming out to Eye of the Tiger as MSG just explodes.
Awesome.
Hogan meets up with Mr. T, who fires him up at ringside before the match. Just an amazing atmosphere and event. Tons of chaos, tons of star power and excitement. The match starts really hot. Both guys trading bombs and rolling on the mat while brawling. Hogan starts to hammer away with right hands and slams hard into him with a charge to the corner. Piper's rattled as Hogan slams him twice and drops an elbow. Piper recovers with a clothesline for two, kicks away at the head before choking. Gene notes that all celebrities in attendance. He goes through the names as Piper grabs a sleeper hold. Hogan fights to his feet and leverages Piper to the top turnbuckle to force the break. Piper's up first and keeps on the pressure, getting an assist from Orton, but Hogan fights him off and spikes his injured arm off the turnbuckle. Piper begs off as Hogan clobbers him and cracks him with a clothesline. Orndorff comes out to ringside and says he's taking Orton's place as Hogan hits an atomic drop. Piper nails Hogan, who bumps the ref, allowing Orndorff to head to the top rope and drop a tight knee to the chest of Hogan. Piper and Orndorff kick away at Hogan as the crowd chants for T. Lauper hops on the apron. David Wolf stops her from getting the ring. And I love how Lauper always gets physically involved in this stuff. Like, I thought that really helped her legend and her quality as a wrestling performer. Because I think she gets overlooked a lot with how good she was. Like, her promos were on point. She understood what was going on. She always wanted to get in the action. She was a little spitfire, jumping on the apron, trying to always get in the fight. Like, I thought it really added to her aura that she didn't seem above it all, you know? So she hops on the apron, gets pulled down. Piper and Orndorff corner her. T finally hops the railing to protect her. T attacks as Hogan recovers. We get a flood of security, and agents hit the ring as everyone gets broken apart. Hogan gets his hands on Piper, pulled off as Piper and Orndorff eventually escape. Hogan and T shake hands as the ring clears out. Hogan and T pose and celebrate with Albano, Lauper, and Wolf to wrap things up. And I thought the whole thing was red hot, an awesome spectacle, really well booked and executed. Got fans and viewers buzzing. I thought they used MTV brilliantly. They tied it all together. I went 2.5 for the whole package because to me the match was just a little lacking in action. I actually think, and I guess we'll talk about this more in a couple weeks, but I actually think the atmosphere of this match felt bigger than what we'd get at WrestleMania when it comes to star power and all that involved.
Yeah. I thought I was the only one that thought that. And I think it's because WrestleMania had, like, older luminaries, whereas MTV had all this young, you know, it just felt younger and more vibrant. And, I mean, that building was nuclear when Eye of the Tiger hit. Nuclear. I mean, is there, other than Flair, is there a better heel in the business right now?
Than Piper?
Yeah, I mean, nobody knows how to fucking just make you want to just kick his teeth down his throat than Piper does right now. Comes in with the Hogan shirt. He's, you know, fucking flipping the bird to everybody. The Elmwood Society playing the bagpipes, just, I mean, it's just fucking awesome. He's just so grandiose and so pompous. It's awesome. It's utterly awesome. This is why Vince brought him in. This is why Vince took him from Crockett for this reason.
Do you think he envisioned him as being a top heel?
Yes.
Because remember, he came in as a manager.
I know
it's because he was hurt, but do you really think they saw him? Do you feel like they saw him as the guy or as the manager to the guy? Because I feel like maybe they wanted Orndorff to be the guy, and they saw Piper as a way to vehicle to get him there.
I don't know. I mean, Orndorff was a great heel, but Piper was just such a fucking heat magnet. I don't think you could have wasted that on just a manager. Nah, I don't know. Now, mind you, obviously, you know, Piper's
he left Crockett in 83 as a babyface. He wasn't really a heel in, and I'll have, you know, I'll have to look back on the other guys. Some of the PWO guys could back me up on this, but I'm pretty sure like most of 81 and 82 in Crockett, in Mid-Atlantic, he was a heel. And I think it was like by mid late 82 is when he turns babyface. Then he's feuding with the Hammer over the U.S. title, mm-hmm, in the dog collar match, etc. So when he came to the WWF, he was a babyface. But in this year plus, I mean, he's just on fire.
Yeah.
And maybe that was why the title match is here. So I'll gain a little credence to your theory. Otherwise, if he was the guy...
No, I think that was more about wanting T in the match.
Hmm. So then you don't think that this is a throw... So do you think this is a throwaway to lead to this? I mean, I guess it is to a certain extent, because the match really isn't much.
No. Yes, yeah. This is a throwaway match to get to Mania, and then I think they figured they'd do Hogan Piper some more for the title after. Which they do.
Right.
Like, I think that was the plan more than not seeing Piper as a threat. I think he's a contender now, the guy now. My argument was that when he, because you said this was their plan when he came in, I didn't know if they actually saw him at this point when he debuted, or if they saw him more as like the mouthpiece for the guy. That's more what I meant. I think at this point it's clear that he could be drawing big money with Hogan. I mean, they're putting him in the, you could argue in many ways that this was a bigger show than WrestleMania. Like, I know they always talk about WrestleMania being, you know, all the money on the line, if this isn't a success, blah, blah, blah. But, I mean, this was their best chance to reach a major audience. Like, they're not putting just any schlub in this match. I mean, if they just wanted to showcase Hogan and get him over, they would have thrown, like, a Nikolai out there or something. Like, they clearly wanted him. They clearly saw Piper as a mega, mega draw. I mean, the heat he picked up from the Lauper stuff alone was enough. I mean, so I think by this point, they see him as a legit draw. I just wonder if when he debuted, if they really saw him at that point, or if it's when he started getting the ring and the snooka stuff is what took him next level.
I don't know. I mean, he was. Yeah. I mean, he was pretty red hot, though.
What did you think of the match?
The match itself is not much. Hmm. I mean, it's a decent brawl, but
did
I think it was just a means to an end. Yeah.
Do you think it's successful in what they aimed to do?
Oh, no doubt.
Okay.
They wanted the chaos, the fucking cops coming in and Piper just getting grabbed and, you know, T going bonkers, knowing he was. I think the best part about it in that end part was knowing that Mr. T really wasn't sure what he was supposed to do and when to do it. I think they wanted him to, because normally, you know, the faces will beg off, stay in the, well, the heels will beg off, walk away, while the babyface will stay in the ring and jaw jack. No, when Piper and Orton and Orndorff left the ring, T got out of the ring and chased them.
Yeah.
Which I don't think they, at one point, I don't think they expected, but at the same time, that's what they wanted. For him to be. Make no mistake
with you. This is it. Well, I like too that T.
Settle this goal.
I like that T wasn't involved, that he came out of the crowd. To me, that really helped things as well. You know what I mean? Like, if he had been part of the show, that chaotic feeling may have been lessened just a little bit. The fact that he's in the crowd and comes over the railing and gets involved, like, and the crowd is begging him to do it, and then he finally does it, that to me built the hype way more than if he had, like, been in Hogan's corner or ringside or something like that, you know?
Yeah. No, I agree. I think it just added to the ridiculous, you know, the ridiculous unpredictability of it. And I mean, it's just, it's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. And it leads to the build from here on out.
I guess we can cover that Mania, but do you agree at all with what I had said about this almost feels more effective for what they were going for, a Mania? Like, when I think of some, maybe it's just me not having really been cognizant at this time period, but the right. Star is, you know, in quotes, at Mania, Liberace, the Rockettes. I don't, you know what I mean? Like some of the ones, I guess Ali was huge, but.
Well, like I said, I think, I feel like they kind of aged up the celebrities.
Right.
At Mania, but I think they should have kept it relatively young for Mania as well.
Yeah, because there's such a divide. I mean, here you definitely get that MTV generation of star. I mean, I guess Mania has it too, but you're right. It does feel more mature.
Yeah. And I think this is just chaos. I didn't feel we'll get more into it when we do Mania, but I didn't feel the chaos as much at Mania than I did here. With the cops and everything, and it just, you know, holding security and guys getting yanked all over the place and just uttered. I mean, it was just, it's just crazy. It's just crazy. And I feel it wasn't that chaotic at WrestleMania.
No, because that was meant to more be the blow-off.
Right.
You've already sold everyone, you know what I mean? This was more to get them in the building for that. So we go backstage after the match. Gene heads to the back to interview Alan Hunter, who, of course, is the MTV BJ. Gives his take on what went down, and he had zero insight. he's like, he's just happy that Rock and Roll came out on top, man. Like, he has, like, nothing to say at all. He is completely lost. You know, he's just... And I guess he had done... I saw it on YouTube where he did, like, a preview show, him and Gene on MTV, about this. But he just looks like... He's like, whatever, just get me the fuck out of here. He's like, yeah, I'm just happy Rock and Roll came out on top. So he leaves. Hogan comes in, cuts a red-hot promo, saying he would... my favorite line. I would die for Rock and Roll and the title. So he's really laying his life on the line for the future of Rock and Roll. David Wolfe and Cyndi Lauper come in, and they put over a bunch of people banding together as one for a tremendous cause. Hogan says Lauper risked her life for the Rock and Roll Wrestling Connection. And Lauper says she was there to protect her friend and then trashes Piper on Orphan Orton. I mean, if you're not in the know and you're just watching this and you didn't get all fucking jacked up, I don't know what was wrong with you. It's like, I mean, they're making it like this is life or fucking death right now. It's just like Piper hates... He may as well have been the old man, you know, shaking his stick on the porch, right? Just, he hates rock and roll. He hates, you know, kids and everything else. It's like, and Hogan is willing to die for the future of rock and roll. And Cyndi Lauper risked her life against Roddy Piper to protect the image of rock and roll. It's like, they're really selling this thing like just a war, like life and death war.
Mm-hmm.
She says that they weren't man enough to fight one-on-one. What'd you say?
Oh, it's epic. We're going to continue.
It is. So T comes in, says he didn't like chumps, and that's why he got involved. He said he loves going to as many wrestling matches as he could to see good, clean action. But tonight he had to step in to protect Lauper. T tells Hogan he has his back anytime he needs him. Albano comes in and puts over Lauper for stepping in, and Hogan and T for coming together as a team. Andy Warhol comes in and is completely speechless. And according to Jeff Jarvis in a note he found, Warhol accidentally walked into that room. He wasn't supposed to be coming in. So he just, since it was being live, he just kind of improvised a short promo. But he doesn't really say much at all. He's just like, it was great. I was speechless. It was great. And then he leaves. So Gene, like, tries hard to pull an answer out of him, and he just mumbles. Joe Piscopo comes in. Talk about 1985. Joe Piscopo comes in. Talks about how hot and exciting everything in the main event was. Says the women's match was hot, too. And he'll definitely be back March 13th. Billy Squire comes in next. He trashes Orndorff for smashing a guitar and says he'll smash it over Orndorff's head if it ever comes to it. And can you clue me in a little bit more on Billy Squire? Was he just a musician?
Billy Squire was a musician, had a great album called Just Say No in 1981. You know the song The Stroke?
Yes.
That's him.
Okay, that's right.
Stroke me. Yeah, that's awesome.
Okay, gotcha. Well, anyway, he says he'll be back. And
yeah, I don't know why. I saw that. I'm like, what the fuck is he doing here? It's kind
right,
of random.
Smash a guitar in order. I like that he's coming in one after the other. And then fucking Danny DeVito comes in, puts over Albano and the teaming of T and Hogan. And mentions his upcoming film Wise Guys, which Albano's going to be in. Says this is his first ever live wrestling event, and he'll definitely be back. And as a big fan of It's Always Sunny, it's weird to see DeVito, like, kind of slimmer with hair. Like, I'm used to fat Frank Reynolds, all fucking bald and puffed up. So that was weird. Piper interrupts wearing just a towel, which is great. Cuts an awesome promo. He tells Hogan to fight one-on-one or just hand over the title like a man. Hogan calls Piper a coward. He says, Piper calls him a coward. Piper says he left Hogan lying like a piece of garbage and says he was never pinned. And he is the true champion. He tells Hogan to bring whoever he wants, including the little black man, before he storms off. Gene and Alan Hunter wrap things up. This is awesome. Like, this is like the highlight of the fucking show to me, this post show on MTV. Brilliant formatting. Like, I mean, they booked this thing like legendarily to a T.
Yep.
No pun intended.
No pun intended.
For MTV. Like, who gives a fuck about the wrestling? You know what I mean? Like, who cares about Hogan and Piper in the ring? 740, perfect length. Like, they didn't need anything more than that. Let it be. Fine. Give us the hoopla. Give us the crazy brawl. And they give us the 20 minutes of interviews with all celebrities after. Like, that felt like a much bigger deal the way they presented it. And those guys coming in and out of the room and rapid fire talking about what they had witnessed, like, led all the credence in the world seeing, like, the current stars of today coming on MTV and talking about how awesome it was to see this stuff live.
It's anyways, I mean, the electricity, guys just coming in all, and then Danny DeVito comes in after Piper leaves and goes, boy, that guy was really wet. What the fuck was that? Piper coming in with the towel is fucking amazing. He knew the camera was high. He should have just fucking dropped it. But, I mean, it's just, they knew what they were doing. They knew what they were doing. No doubt. And it makes you want, and what's funny is WrestleMania is not even mentioned. None of that stuff is even mentioned yet. And I mean, you're ready to go. I mean, it's just crazy. And all the celebrities and all these artists and even fucking doped up Andy Warhol. I mean, yeah. Who the fuck invited him?
Yeah. I think he was a real wrestling fan, wasn't he? I thought he actually liked wrestling, Andy Warhol.
I guess he did, but I mean, at least you would know what the hell you're talking about.
Yeah.
I don't know. Even if you walked in by accident.
I thought he actually liked wrestling.
I don't think he did. No. If he did, then he should have been more better prepared. But and then Joe Piscopo, who at the time showed up to fucking everything. So, I mean, that's crazy. I mean, I don't know what else to say. I mean, there's a great version of it on YouTube, unless you have your 24/7 tape. If you taped it back in the day, I know you did, but we weren't going to go buried into the cupboards to go look for it. This version's 10 times better when this gentleman on YouTube kind of spliced in the original Cyndi Lauper and Hulk Hogan entrances with the original theme songs. It's fucking awesome. Mm-hmm. You got to watch it.
Well, it's funny because when I got to the main event and there was like 40 minutes left, I'm like, holy shit, this match is this long? And then
I know. I totally
it ended and I was like, what the hell, you know, like, what is the end going to be? And then what ended up being like 20 minutes of that awesomeness, I was like, oh, this is great. I mean, this was... It was really good. Yeah, I really enjoyed that part of it. It really added to the spectacle. Yeah, this is a good show. It was a really good show.
For those that didn't, who are younger fans who may have just watched WrestleMania 1 like as a standalone vacuum, you're like, wow, this show is boring. Watch these two shows that we've done the last 2 weeks, the one we're doing next week, and then WrestleMania. Watch those four in a row, and I think you'll get a better understanding of someone like me who was watching at that time, and some of the, you know, like me or D'Amato or somebody who, you know, those that watched it when they were, you know, watching it for real that at that time. And you'll understand that the build was just so much crazier than you thought it would be just watching it as a random, you know, just, oh, I'm going to throw WrestleMania 1 in kind of thing, you know. You just, if you watch that build from beginning to end, even if you go back to that December 28th, 84 house show, if you watch that to WrestleMania 1, it's just, you're wondering what the deal is. I mean, you're literally wondering what the deal is. But it's just, it's ridiculous. It's utterly ridiculous. And how amazing they put this together. And using like a second network, a fledgling network, really, even though it was 4 years old, to put this together. Amazing. What a job by Vince and whoever owned MTV at the time.
Kevin Dunn.
Hey guys, check out Billy Squire. You know.
All right, let's go through our awards here for the evening. So I pull this up. What do you have for your match of the night?
I had to go with Leilani Kai and Wendi Richter.
Really, over the main event?
Yeah. Because if you're just talking about the match standalone. The women's match.
No, it's everything. Everything goes into everything.
Oh, well, then I would definitely put the main event. Yeah, okay. I put the main event.
It's everything. It's not never just a work rate. And especially in 1980s WWF, we're not.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah, all put right. The main event.
So
yeah,
you went, all right. So what? My worst match of the night was Rivera and Rods, which I thought was a fucking train wreck.
Yeah, I had originally thought the tag title, but you really can't put worst match for a, 20-second squash.
No, that was well booked.
That
thank God.
I mean, that Rods match is bad. I mean, that San Martino, fucking Moondog Rex match is atrocious. All right, I'll stick with you with Rivera and Johnny Rods, but that Moondog Rex David San Martino match comes pretty close.
They were both real bad.
They're both pretty awful.
All right, your MVP.
Everybody in the main event.
Yep, that's what I had too.
Everybody. Piper, Hogan, T, Orton, Mean Gene, Andy Warhol. I mean, everybody. Alan Hunter was as clueless as he was. Everybody.
Everything.
Everybody. That whole last, 45 minutes of that show is pure gold.
Mm-hmm.
Pure gold.
Okay, so we agree there. Your spoiler award. Worst work.
The spoiler award, Jose Luis Rivera.
That's my choice. Yep.
Yeah, and it's pretty awful.
He was awful. He was all over the place. He really looked lost out there. For a guy had been around for a little bit too. It's like it was his debut. He definitely was lost. So I'm good with that. Best moment.
I originally was going to put, even with the greatness of the main event, I originally was going to put the moment when Leilani Kai shocked the building and won the belt, but I've got to put everything after the bell rang in the main event. That last 20 minutes is just fucking, it's just ridiculous.
Yeah, that's what I had too. So we're gonna.
You got to put it. It's ridiculous.
And your juice award.
I mean, it's pretty cut and dry. You got to go with Tony Atlas. I mean, he's fucking gigantic.
Yeah, I was kind of leaning towards McGraw.
No waste.
I was leaning towards McGraw again, but yeah, I think Atlas. Atlas was so lean, the appearance wasn't quite there, but yeah, he was pretty jacked. McGraw's still hanging in though.
But McGraw and even David Bruno David, I think he injects it in his ass, and then his ass just gets full of roids.
So we're gonna call this the Mr. USA Award, by the way, going forward. overall grade.
I'm giving it a 6. I mean, it's. There were some stinkers. If we're looking at it overall, I mean, some of the we talked about some of the early matches on this card are abysmal, but the women's title switch, which was shocking, and then the main event, it's just amazing. I mean, it's just amazing. The build, what this show did. Even with the stinkers early on, Orton. I was surprised Orton lost, but I guess you need to split the difference between Orndorff winning.
Mm. Yeah, so, Orton's whatever. He's beatable.
Yeah.
The coattails.
Yeah. So I mean, it's definitely a show you need to watch. It's probably one of the most memorable house shows in the history of the Garden.
So I went 5.5. But I'll qualify it with this. If you were to watch a version that doesn't have the war to settle the score cut in, so you don't get the MTV feed with the after stuff, I'd probably feel a lot less. Because to me, the only real thing of worth seeing at all was the end of the women's title, and I guess most of the women's title, and then the beginning and the end of the main event. To me, everything else was, I thought, worse than January. I thought January had a little bit more excitement, with the Andre match and some of the other stuff.
Right.
To me, the MTV aspect of it and all the chaos and the post-interview, that added so much to the show for me that it bumped it two whole points. I probably would have went 3.5 for just the regular standard house show version of this. But with this cut that we had, with all the MTV hoopla tagged on, I thought was worth a couple extra points.
Yeah. It's that good. It's that good. And if you find this version, it's amazing. Mm. It's honestly amazing.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun to see.
Yeah.
All right. So there you go.
All right, there we go.
Another MSG house show in the books. Yes. Hope you enjoyed it. We'll be back next week. We'll be looking at March 17th, 1985. So one more show to go before Mania. May have a special guest on that show. We'll confirm throughout the week here, and then he'll see. And then the week after that, Scott, on Christmas Eve, likely, so half a week after that, we'll be airing our Christmas special. So
yes,
check that out. It'll be fun as always. And then next show after that will be into 2017. So
yes, we will.
So 2 weeks in, how you feeling?
I feel fantastic.
Yeah.
It's so much fun. Not only to go through some of these awesome moments and kind of bringing back stuff from my childhood, but looking back at what was going on in pop culture, movies and, you know, sports teams and, you know, your little Yankee t-shirt that you had on at 5 years old and, you know, Gazzo bringing home some, cool, you know, liquor, stuff for the basement, the Coors Light over the pool table. And, you know, it's pretty awesome. Or was that already there by 1985? Or did he get that
pool table?
No, yeah, Coors Light. The Coors Light over
it. Oh, the Coors Light thing? Ah, God, I don't remember. Yeah, it probably came a little bit later.
Okay. I know the pool table was there for a while, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. What about the puppy poster? Ah, never mind. This is great. Because it's stoking memories of when I was watching it live and how amazing just all these guys were. And then we kind of break down the questions that we always ask ourselves when we're watching these shows standalone. Now that we're watching them together in a stream, we can get some answers, we think.
Right.
We hope to, anyway. You know, why this guy was on, why this guy wasn't on, that kind of thing. So I'm excited. I'm looking forward to the next show. I don't think I watched this whole house show coming up in a while. I know the main event is on, I think it's on that 80s comp. And then there's the pit, of course, that was announced. But I don't remember the other show, the other car, the other matches on it. I'm sure we're going to get our share of stinkerinos. But
we'll see in a week.
We'll have to see. Yep.
All right. So why don't we go ahead then? We're going to wrap things up. Again, hope everyone enjoyed the new direction. We had lots of good feedback, by the way. Thank you for everyone who chimed in and let us know
how
much you were enjoying the kind of the refresh we're doing here. So thank you to everyone who shared and continue to share feedback. Share your thoughts on the awards we talk about. Give your version of the awards. And really, just let us know how you feel about everything else. So for Scott, I'm Justin, we're out. We'll talk to you next week back in MSG. Everyone take care. It's petty time, by the way. Petty time.
Luck's looking good.
This is it for Ryan Fitzpatrick's career.
He gets sepsis. You are-